the writers and stars of TV Land's new show, Teachers, the Chicago improv group, The Katydids, bass player and composer Victor Wooten, and Chicago rapper Saba. Now here's your host, a man who wants the world to know that he is a believer, Justin Kaufman.
It took a lot for me to admit that, but I am believing. I'm not going to be like everybody else and be like out of touch. I'm in touch. Skrillex, Diplo, Bieber. I'm hip. Hip with the kids. I don't know, man. You heard the new stuff? The new Bieber that's all over the mix and all the hot spots, like the mix. I love it. I don't want them saying I'm sorry. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Oh, man. Gosh, I wish I was like a 17-year-old girl. The music right now is just out of control. So good. When I jam Bieber, everyone's like, all right, calm down, old man. So, welcome to The Download. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on WGN Radio. What a hot show tonight. Think of our show like your very own space heater, right? We'll get you warm for a few hours, but then you just got to remember to shut us off before you go to bed because of the fire hazard. Wait, I kind of lost the metaphor there. But anyway, we got a great hot show for you to keep you company tonight. It's a big day at City Council and the Cook County Board as 2016 is officially underway. Mike Fouché joins us to talk about all the political news, including new police shooting videos, an MLK breakfast boycott, and a possible Cook County Democratic Party endorsement for Kim Fox. That'd be interesting. That's coming up tomorrow. Also tonight, we got a few premieres on this show. Very excited about this. First, the comedians that make up the all-female improv group, The Katydids, premiere their new television show tonight on TV Land. It's called Teachers. Before you watch it, get their origin story here. Three of the six members are in studio tonight. We'll talk about the show and how they got there in the 9 o'clock hour. And also, West Side rapper Saba is riding high after being featured on Chance the Rapper's single Angels. Tonight, he joins me, and he's dropping a brand new track. That's right. Tonight, Chicago. It's the Chicago radio premiere on WGN Radio 720 AM. Exactly how they wrote it up in the marketing plan for the Saba crew, right? I feel like I'm Dan Cortez or I'm like Julian Jumpin' Perez. Yo, yo, we got the hot new Saba. You call right now, we'll get you a six-pack of Pepsi and a couple tickets to Great America. Or give you the Coke can so you get $10 off. That's right, Julian Jumpin' Perez. Here's a new Saba. I play right up to... We should try that tonight. We should play the track over and over, and I should just work on my post. You know, where I talk right before he raps. Here it is, the latest from Saba. And if I get it wrong, we got to do it again. And again and again and again. Well, that's coming up. We're going to talk with the... 21 years old, this kid. And he is blowing up in Chicago and putting the West Side on the hip-hop map. We'll talk with Saba coming up at 10 o'clock. Also, my guest tonight at the big table, Victor Wooten. Wooten is widely considered to be one of the best bass players in the world. He made the top 10 of all time by Rolling Stone magazine, and he's won 5 Grammys, most of them for his work with Bella Fleck and the Flecktones. He's premiering new work at the MLK Day annual concert held by the Chicago Sinfonietta, and he's in studio tonight to talk about it. Can't wait. And finally tonight, why are parents at Morgan Park High School threatening to boycott Saturday's big game against Simeon? Well, Sam Panjanovich will update us that story and all things high school hoops later in the show. All that plus news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago, starring those who know it best. All right. So now, for the rest of the show, we're just going to play a bunch of Bieber. Just, we can play all of it. What do you mean? Do it all night. I'm going to play Bieber all night. Get ready. And I'm also like a month and a half late. Like, he was so hot, like, before Christmas, and just classic me. Oh, what's this I hear? Oh, I've been hearing it so much and not paying attention. Now I'm listening. Yeah, Bieber, man. Bieber, the new Drake. That's what I say. Anyway, it's time for the carry out. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the newspaper so you at home, you don't have to.
Bum, 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 bum
today's top stories. The city paved the way for a new police shooting video to be released because it's 2016. We could probably count on one of these per month. This is a 2013 incident where police shot and killed an unarmed teen who was running away from them. The city said they're releasing the video in the spirit of being transparent. This, of course, after they filed a protective order to seal it back in 2013, which wasn't a very transparent year. But hey, it learns. This story comes on the heels of a DNA info story that says the police are doing the least amount of work possible to avoid putting themselves out there for scrutiny, which, by the way, is the tagline of the Maury Povich show. But police morale is nothing to scoff at. Don't get me wrong. I love running stop signs without protest. But something tells me a motivated police force is good for all parties. I mean, let's do what any corporation does when morale's low. Taco Tuesday. Or how about a chai tea hour? Ooh, everybody loves chai tea. Or even better yet, Powerball ticket for every police officer. I mean, that makes everybody feel good, right? Governor Rauner wants to look into eliminating consent decrees. Now, that may sound political, and yes, we should get rid of them, because I don't know what it is. Get rid of it now. But consent decrees are essentially court-ordered payments to departments like Children and Family Services because the state has been delinquent, shady, and downright criminal about not paying them in the past. So now Rauner wants to get rid of them because turnaround? It's like a guy who's on a court-ordered payment system for child support because he was delinquent for years saying, you know what's holding me back? Being forced to pay this. Come on. A spokesperson for the Hillary Clinton campaign went on the attack, calling out that Bernie Sanders' health care plan couldn't be implemented without taxing the middle class. Critics point out that this is a Republican talking point over past health care plans, including Obamacare. Wait, Hillary Clinton waffling back and forth between Democrat and Republican? That doesn't sound right. Also, didn't we see this locally? Didn't Rahm Emanuel, Hillary's biggest backer, say that his opponent, Chewy Garcia, Bernie Sanders' biggest backer, would raise taxes and we all somehow fell for it since Rahm essentially did it anyway, the highest in Chicago history? Nah, why are we such sheep? Or better yet, why do our shepherds suck so bad? Speaking of Rahm, the Trib editorial board took a big swipe at him yesterday, saying essentially he's a terrible mayor. But to the Trib board's credit, they're just rerunning editorials from last year and the year before and the year before and the year before that, which is why it's so baffling that they endorsed him for mayor. Man, you know who I'm gonna miss, though? Obama. Did you see that State of the Union last night? Man, he is the best behind a podium. Could you imagine Hillary Clinton doing a State of the Union or Trump or Cruz or Sanders? It's like wanting to watch Joni Loves Chachi instead of Happy Days. Although I had one problem, is talk of this new economy. I don't get it. What's the new economy he speaks so highly of? The $11 sandwich at lunchtime? Or is it the buy one, get the second one half off sale at the Banana Republic? Or wait, is he talking about newspaper paywalls? Or $4 tolls? Or $25 to carry on a bag? Or paying for every single city and state service 20% more than you did last year? Is that the new economy he's talking about? Or wait, is he just talking about weed? I think he's talking about weed. A shooting today on the Skyway closed a big part of the toll road. Wait a second, let me get this straight. I pay $10 to take the Skyway to go to Valpo. That should be the toll I pay to not get shot. Just an assumption. I mean, I get it. I could get shot on 94. That's like Mad Max. That's Fury Road. That road's free. But the toll road? The Skyway? I pay for that. You know what should happen? Everyone should get one free toll for this news. I mean, you could put it on one of the cheaper ones, like, you know, the ramp to get off in Oak Brook. But still, one free toll. Powerball tonight, if nobody wins $2 billion. I hate Powerball. No, you know what? I take that back. I don't hate Powerball. I hate news reports about Powerball. Oh, did you buy that ticket? How was standing in line at 7-Eleven? Oh, it was great. It's really great. I bought another one. What's the point? In weather, it's so cold, my thighs are numb. That's cold. In sports, the Blackhawks won their eighth in a row. Eight in a row. Wake me up when they hit 15. I mean, that's just what we expect from the best sports franchise in Chicago. And while you're at it, do more Chevy commercials where you skate up to the screen and sell me a Malibu. I like that. The NFL's relocating not one but two franchises to the L.A. market. Poor San Diego, poor St. Louis. But you know what? I guess that works for all involved because nobody wants to watch, play, or be involved with any football in St. Louis. I just hope that they draft the right type of players, you know, to like embody the city of Los Angeles. I want to see some burned out hippies on the field, maybe some wannabe actors, Bloods and Crips, Kardashians. I mean, who else lives out there, right? They hired a 32-year-old broadcaster to replace Hawk Harrelson at White Sox games this season. Hawk will still travel with the team for road games, but still, it's going to be weird not hearing him say stretch or he gone or you could put it on the board, willy dilly billy.
Or he doesn't actually say that last one, but doesn't it seem like he would? I know people hate his style. He was named one of the worst by GQ magazine, but I love it. Broadcasters are supposed to be unique, be homers, be eccentric. Otherwise, we're just encouraging a new generation of Joe Bucks. And really, nobody wants that. Oh yeah, and the Bulls lost again. 3 in a row. Come on. And finally, Chipotle is worried that they may have an image crisis after E. coli and norovirus outbreaks at their restaurants. You know what? Just this one time, I'll give you some advice for your new marketing campaign. Are you ready? Get a pencil ready. Chipotle, wash your hands. Huh? Hey, that's the carryout for January 13, 2016. Hey, did you order the hot soup? Man, that was a really dumb idea because it's not going to stay hot. We all know that.
Coming up, we'll talk about what happened at City Council today, also the Cook County Board, also news that the City of Chicago is not going to fund any CPS for 2016, pushing it back to Springfield. Christine Mardonia just put out a statement. We'll talk about that coming up. It's a download here on WGN. Stay with us. Hey, Chicago Blackhawks fans, come with WGN Radio and spend a hockey-filled three-day weekend away in Minneapolis this February 20th through the 22nd. Any word yet if we're going on that trip?
Still working on that.
You're still working on
that?
Yeah. I think this would, you know, I ran into Scott King. He does the Blackhawks podcast.
Blackhawks
for,
crazy, yeah.
Yeah, for WGN Plus, and I told him of my New Year's resolution to become a diehard hockey Blackhawks fan. You know, I'm a fan. I know all about it, and you know, I'm not fair weather. I love the Hawks and love everything about it, and obviously pay more attention to playoff time than regular season. But I want to change that. I want to get into every night. These games have been so exciting to watch. So Scott said he'd come in and he'd quiz me to make sure that I'm
kind of be like your tutor, perhaps.
Yeah. So like, you know, he'll throw some stuff out and try to. It's almost like teaching me a foreign language.
Yeah.
You know, like, am I in the proper form?
Hey, Pete, what do you say you and I go in together and get Justin Hockey for Dummies?
Yeah. I don't need Hockey for Dummies. I've got my dummies right here. No, I mean, I know the game, and I know it pretty well.
You just want to know.
I feel like.
Do you understand you get past, with offsides yeah, and icing yeah, and all yeah, that kind yeah, of yeah. stuff?
And I understand the game. What I would like to know more about is just the second tier, second line guys. Like, for instance, Chicago Bulls. I'm a Bulls fan, love the Bulls. I could tell you every guy that's coming off the bench, right? I know all the players, the 13 players. I know everybody. I know their strengths, where they came from, why. If the tall white guy, I forgot his name, is on the floor, the Bulls are getting blown out. I forgot. Which guy is the Australian guy? Anyway, when he's on the floor, I know they're getting blown out. So, with hockey, it's harder for me because I know Kane, I know Taves, I know, Shaw, I know...
You want to know Andrew Desjardins.
Right, that's exactly right. Because I've kind of lost, I mean, I've reported on the people who got traded and things like that, but I feel like I need to know...
You want to know Bradford, Ontario's very own Brandon Machinter.
Right. When Machinter comes
Don't
on, like...
panic.
When Machinter comes on, I'd be like, good, because he's a great skater. Or his skill is to do that. Oh, good. We need a little Machinic right now. Slow this game down. You know, I don't know what. Like, that's what I want to get at. So that's where I'm hoping that you guys, Download Nation, Scott, others can help.
Yeah. Well, the thing I admire about you, Justin, is you
my V-neck sweaters?
Yeah. Your follow-through has been... Mwah. You're wearing the V-neck sweater again.
This so is day 13.
I'm very confident that you're going to follow through on this Hawks
thing. How's the no-sugar thing going?
It's been dynamite.
All right. You feel good?
Been a son of a bitch to most other people, but...
He didn't say hi to me today.
I haven't noticed much of a change. But I'm... You know what? If you could just give me a list of some people to call, some references, you know, in your daily life, I can ask them a couple questions, see how it's going.
All right.
Because if there's any change whatsoever, you're going back on the sugar.
I waved and he grunted at me.
See, Martyr is not buying this no sugar cinnamon. All right, you'll travel by chartered coach north to the Twin Cities to see the outdoor alumni game at the University of Minnesota campus. Then on Sunday, you get the Blackhawks facing the Wild at the 2016 Coors Light NHL Stadium Series outdoor game. Call 800-881-8804 to book your tour, to find pricing and booking information at WGNradio.com/events. Yeah, someone just texted in. It's Bairstow, the Australian guy who comes off the bench for the Bulls. And then someone said, what'd you say it was, Rob? It was Machinic?
Machinter.
Yes. They said the nickname should be Masher.
Brandon Machinter from Bradford, Ontario.
That's the key. I mean, that's what I want to know. I want to know what the nicknames are. So I don't have to do that whole formal thing that you just did right there, Machinter, from
you know what,
Ontario.
But today it's like Taser, Kaner, yeah, that right. sort of thing. I mean, back in the day, Doug Gilmore's nickname was Killer. The guy was only like 5'9", but they called him Killer.
We're good at that. The Download is good at coming up with nicknames for people.
Do that.
So maybe we throw some nicknames around a little bit. I like that. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Victor Wooten is here.
Richard Wooten?
No, Victor Wooten.
Victor Wooten.
Richard Wooten, no. Victor Wooten, who is the top 10 bass players of all time.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah.
Right.
No, but I'm telling you, Bella Fleck and the Flecktones is where he plays. He's got 5 Grammys.
Yeah, I've got their albums.
He's playing at the CSO on Monday. He's got a new piece, Chicago Premiere, the Bass Whisperer. Amazing. If you go on YouTube, just check out Victor Wooten. It's stuff that I didn't know a bass could do. I'm very excited to talk to him about not only just his new music, about his life in music, but his craft and, you know, life as a bass player. So we'll talk with him coming up at 8 o'clock at the big table right now. Well, City Council and the Cook County Board both in session today, the first of 2016, in studio with me for our weekly chat, Mike Fouché. He's the man behind AlderTrack.com, a subscription newsletter that covers everything Chicago politics, also Illinois politics. Good to see you, Mike.
Good to be here.
So big day today because and there was a lot of hype for this because you saw articles popping up saying because of what the aldermen perceived to be political blood in the water with Rahm Emanuel, they're
right.
standing up.
Right.
They're becoming independent.
Yar.
All of them.
Yar.
What was the tone at the meeting today?
There are a couple of things that happened that were significant. One is that the mayor has this giant bond package that he wanted to push through for borrowing. And, you know, one of the misnomers that people have is that you pass the bond package and then everyone goes out, they go and sell the bonds and they borrow it. But usually it's not until many, many months later. So they get the authorization and then they do all the selling of bonds much, much later. So originally the mayor on Monday brought to Finance Committee a package that was significantly larger. I think it was like $3.2 billion. It was really big. And there was a lot of pushback in Finance Committee. And so they cut one of the big issues down by $650 million because aldermen are like, man, that's too much. And so then there's one particular bond vehicle, one thing that was linked to the water department in order to fund capital projects for water. And the city, so I have an MBA, all right? And I at one point worked for the chief economist of the U.S. Department of Energy, an incredibly intelligent man who wrote most of the 1986 U.S. federal tax reforms. So I think I know something about this stuff, okay?
Right.
I've thought about these things, and the city has some incredibly, incredibly complicated financial vehicles for some of the bonds. And one of them was this series of swaps, and I'm not even going to try and tell anybody here what the swaps are because your eyes and ears will bleed from just trying to understand it. But there, some of the water bonds were extraordinarily complicated. And apparently late last night, aldermen, realizing that this was going to come to city council, hit the phones, and there was just all aldermanic cell phones were buzzing like mad. It was like The Wire, you know, they're all calling each other. And so then apparently they all started bombarding Burke with phone calls late last night and saying, you got to take this off the agenda. And so what ended up happening was that in the middle of the meeting, Burke announced, we're going to put a hold on this for a month. So that... in and of itself.
Is progress?
That there's a $400 million package that the city said, well, you know, maybe we'll come back later. That was a big deal.
Well, it's somewhat unheard of because there's always been this rubber stamp, especially when it comes to the
right.
Finance Committee. Ed Burke runs it.
Right.
Whatever he says
right.
goes.
Right.
And so
right.
to hear that there actually been pushback and people are reading
this or thinking
about it.
Effectively, $1 billion of
yeah.
borrowing
has been a step in the right direction.
Stalled. That's a big deal.
Now, we may still need that borrowing. It may still happen. But the idea that the aldermen were I guess, active.
Yes.
Is new.
That, totally new.
Golf clap for the aldermen.
So I think that was a big deal. The other is that there were a whole series of other things that went on. Actually, one thing that went on was that there was a eulogy for Alderman Maldonado's wife, Alderman Maldonado from the 26th Ward. He lost his mother, and then 6 days later, his wife died.
That's terrible.
And he gave a speech, which a number of people said to me it was all they could do to not start bawling. It was pretty intense. So, you know, there were some of the big stuff and then also some of the other things going on.
Well, you know, like whenever there's a press whenever there's a city council meeting, there are press conferences in and around, like everyone likes, because they know the media is going to be there. One of the big ones, and Rokon had Corey Brooks on talking about how pastors are choosing to boycott or skip the annual MLK Day breakfast.
Right. Right.
That's like a unity breakfast that the mayor holds,
the city holds.
And they're saying, we don't want to be a part of it because, I mean, essentially a vote of no confidence when it comes to race relations.
So right before the council meeting, a group of pastors, including Pastor James Dukes, Bishop James Dukes and Pastor Ira Acri, Dukes is from the south side, Acri's from the west side, came up and said that they are leading a group to boycott the mayor's MLK breakfast. And one of the amazing things Zachary said was that the mayor has become a distraction. What? You know, the leader of the city has become a distraction. And then he said, we will not celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday with him because Dr. King's legacy was to be as a advocate for the poor and not an agent for the elite.
Wow.
That was, you know, so
that's well said.
Pastor Acri is no storefront preacher. You know, he's been around for a long time. He's very, very well respected. Bishop Dukes is the same. That's some pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah. Okay, Mike Fouché is with us. Let's take a break. We come back. We'll talk about the Cook County Board. Also, big slating meeting tomorrow with the Cook County Democratic Party. Obviously, the state's attorney's race, who are they going to back? We'll talk about that when we come back.
Air.
Yeah, here with Mike Fouché on the download. Stay with us. It's the download here on WGN. Mike Fouché is with me from AlderTrack. Talking about what happened today at both City Council and the Cook County Board. The Cook County Board met today for the first time in 2016. Big story out of that, I saw the $6 million wrongful death settlement. What's this about?
You know, it's a crazy story. There was a Cook County sheriff that was pursuing somebody in a car off the Bishop Ford Highway into Dalton. And apparently they were going very fast, somewhere around 70 miles an hour. And the sheriff's deputy ended up hitting a 16-year-old boy who was on a bike and killed him. And there's some big questions about, was the sheriff actually pursuing somebody? Why was he going 70 miles an hour when the sheriff's department has a no pursuit policy? And so there were a lot of hinky things that were,
and then there was, you know, good old fashioned politics involved in this too, as Commissioner Boykin said, I'm not voting for it because that commissioner has something to do with
it. So a member of the Cook County Board of Tax Review, Larry Rogers Jr. Is the attorney representing the family of the boy that was killed. You know, the thing is that Larry Rogers Jr.'s stock and trade, what he does for
He reps Sandra Bland's family, Laquan McDonald's family.
He does these sort of civil rights, civil action kind of lawsuits.
Right.
So, you know, I
want to have him on the show because it seems like that's in direct contrast to serving in the Cook County government.
He's on the Board of Tax Review, which is a very specific kind of thing.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, I argue that it's a completely different kind of thing.
Okay, so one of the big issues too that came out didn't necessarily come from the board meeting today, but has to do with this. The newspapers have been writing about this Alvarez versus Preckwinkle,
right?
The Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, the Cook County State's Attorney, they don't see eye to eye, and they're going after each other.
Right.
There seems to be this is all heating up to the election, the primary that's coming up, but. What's to make of
this? Well, you know, one thing that Anita Alvarez has been saying for a while is that Tony Preckwinkle has it out for her, which Tony Preckwinkle actually agrees.
Right.
She says, yes, I do, and I've had it out for her for a number of years.
Right.
And the reason that Tony Preckwinkle cites is that Anita Alvarez doesn't have a sensitive administration in terms of determining what's appropriate for prosecutions, that she's been prosecuting a large number of African-American men with very, very high sentences for relatively minor
offenses,
crimes that are not violent. And Anita Alvarez says, sorry, law's the law, this law is the law, and I'm doing the law. And so Preckwinkle, some time ago, has been sponsoring her former chief of staff, Kim Fox, to run
for
state's attorney.
So the
Cook County Democratic Party decided some months ago, back in the summer, we're not going to make an endorsement in this race between Donna Moore, Kim Fox, and Anita Alvarez. And what's happened since then is the Laquan McDonald case.
Right.
And there is a genuine concern among members of the Cook County Democratic Party, the committeemen, that if Anita Alvarez could win, and that if Anita Alvarez wins and the Cook County Democratic Party allowed it to happen, that would tar the party. And African Americans,
and she would be, not to say that this hasn't happened because it's a hard fight, but she would be vulnerable in a general election against a Republican, and Republicans have won this. I mean, I remember Jack O'Malley won,
that was 25 years ago.
But it could happen. Yeah. I mean, it's always been driven by the Dick Devines and the. But there has been a time where you know weaker candidates have lost in the general.
Absolutely.
But let me ask you about. Is this the influence? Is this why people are calling Tony Preckwinkle the new political boss? I mean, does she have influence on the Cook County Democratic Party? Be like, I really need you to help me here. Is she the one that's pushing this?
She definitely is the one that's pushing it. But does she have some sort of backroom power? I don't think so. I mean, in fact, if you talk to committeemen, they'll say, well, you know, Tony Preckwinkle up to this point has demonstrated that she's not able to win elections for her candidates.
Right.
She's had a number of candidates that she's endorsed and supported that have fallen flat and not gone anywhere.
Is it a no-brainer that it'll be Kim Fox, or does Donna Moore have a chance?
No, it's pretty much a no-brainer that it's going to be Kim Fox. Donna Moore is seen to be more of a Rahm Emanuel candidate, and I think that there is a broad understanding that the Democratic Party in Cook County needs to be supporting an African-American leader at this time. And that's what Kim Fox is.
It'll be interesting to see. I mean, we'll continue our weekly conversations about the election because that's a big race. All eyes going to be on that race.
And, the thing is that, a lot of people forget that Anita Alvarez was a dark horse candidate back in 2008. Nobody really knew who she was. Who is this lady? And there were three other candidates that were much, much more likely to win that everybody talked about. And she essentially won with one really good ad. And the same thing could happen all over again.
Interesting. And you know what? I mean, this would be good. I hope that they agree to debate each other. Or at least Kim Fox and Anita Alvarez and Donna Moore. It'd be fun to talk about this stuff in public. One thing that came out today, which yesterday and today, is more CPS stuff. On this program, you talked about February being kind of the D-date for what's going to happen with money. Carol Brown is the CFO. She came out and said, the city of Chicago is not supporting in any direct way, financially supporting CPS. What is that?
She had a telephone call with reporters yesterday to explain some of the city financial dealings. And I asked her, what's going to happen with CPS? Is the city going to do anything? And she said, quote, at this time, the city of Chicago has no plans to directly financially support CPS. I don't know what it is that's going to happen.
So essentially that's saying that they're not going to kick in. They're not going to try and cover that $400 million hole.
She said that she won't. Bruce Rauner had an interview with Derek Lacely from Channel 2 yesterday. He said he's not going to do anything. And
Christine Redonda just put out a statement this hour that's saying that she's disappointed in the city.
Minority leader.
Why does she? Why do they continually not cover their own stuff and ask us for money? We're not going to give them money.
And so here we are. CPS is capped. They can't
They can't ask us for more money.
They can't increase taxes anymore. They're capped by state law. They can't do any other kind of taxes other than property taxes. So they have two choices now. Since nobody is going to give them money, they can either borrow a ton of money at usurious rates. Already it's been reported by Bond Buyer and Bloomberg that they've been borrowing at like 10 and 12%, which is an insanely,
that's
like three times the going rate for a lot of other places. And the other option is that they lay people off.
Which is a possibility, and that's ridiculous to think about because they're already strapped. If you have any children that are in Chicago public schools right now, no one is overflowing with right. teachers and administrators that are getting the job done. And we're talking about class sizes are way over what the state says they should be at. Is there any way, the only thing, the loophole I could think about, is there any way that they would lift this ban on tax? Like the state could go in, Madigan could go in and say, you know what, that ban is over, tax at will. And this falls on the shoulders
that,
of...
That would require the signature of the governor. And the governor has said, I'm not going to give any
assistance.
They
can't override
the city.
That. Yeah.
They could, maybe. But so far Madigan has had trouble overriding vetoes because right. members of his own caucus have been defecting.
And that's the one thing. The only reason I say that is because it's the one thing that, you know, as an interested party, as a city of Chicago resident, it makes me wonder if this is just posturing to load it more on the backs of the taxpayers. Now, the hope is that won't happen because we've already seen some of the biggest, hikes in property taxes otherwise. But it's possible that they could say the only way out of this is to tax some more.
Well, the structure of education funding for Chicago for a long time has been that the city has its own, you know, stuff for CPS. The feds kick in a bunch of change. And then the state writes a big check every year that goes to the city of Chicago. The state constitution says that 50% of education funding is supposed to come from the state. That has not really happened. It's been effectively around 30 to 35% for a long time, maybe even lower. Mm. And the way that it's worked every year, there's a crazy, terrible funding formula. In order to make up the difference for the funding formula, the state legislature every year said, okay, we're going to fill the gap. Here's a check for $400 million dollars or $300 million, whatever.
And this year with the new governor,
and
he's
this
like,
year,
no,
we're not going to deal with that. It's not going through. Nothing's going to happen. And I think that what Rahner is effectively attempting to do is eradicate that practice. I mean, and he's just going to say, well, you're still going to get the money that's part of the formula, but the rest of the money that, you know, we would make up for is not going
to
happen.
And the city of Chicago is saying, make it the 50% that it's supposed to be. Stop playing these games and giving us 30% and then writing on top.
That's right.
All right. Well, that makes sense. That's the clearest way that I've understood the funding thing, because the politicians never tell you that. Well, they always say, no, but they say, you know, it's really, you know, it's not our responsibility to fund Chicago's Yes, it is.
My job, Justin, is to explain the world to you. That's why you should subscribe to All the Track.
That's right. And download Nation.
With my voice like this.
That's right. Mike Fouché is the man behind AlderTrack.com, a subscription newsletter that covers all things Chicago and Illinois politics. Mike, good to see you.
Good to be here.
I'm fascinated by that, Pete. I'm fascinated about the concept, and maybe I've got it wrong. Maybe Fouché's got it wrong. I don't think he does. But the idea being that if the state constitution says that the state of Illinois needs to pay 50% of its education funding to the CPS, Chicago Public Schools, and they only pay about 30-35 because that's how they've been doing things with budgets and making the numbers work. And then on top, they find the money to write another check for $400 million to be like, here you go. Off the books almost, right? Just because they realize that don't tell our parents, the taxpayers, that we're messing things up. And so Rahner wants to come in and change that to say, stop with the on the top stuff. We're going to pay the 30-35%, but the law says 50. So you can understand why Mayor Emanuel is saying, I'm not paying more. You can understand someone on Twitter, on the text said, what about TIFs? No, that's their money. That's the city of Chicago's money. The state constitution says they're supposed to get 50%. So it's a fight over 15%. I'm fascinated by that. I think that that's an interesting argument, and I'd love to hear people argue why. Maybe there's a great argument to be made about why the state of Illinois should pay less. And I think that's what some of the Republican lawmakers are trying to say, that we need to change the state constitution to say it's less because, you know, they should get the same amount as other districts.
Well, hasn't there been outcry, Justin, from outlying districts about that discrepancy?
Yeah, they have.
Because they've been mad saying, hey, look, we want our fair share. I don't care what the state constitution says.
Right. That's exactly – and I can understand it. And putting no fault on the state legislature, they have to figure out how to balance all that money to be able to make sure that all the, you're right, the surrounding districts get what they're supposed to get and everyone's supposed to get. It's an interesting, and it's so hard to stay on that line. Yeah. Like what I find with this argument all the time is it gets real wavy. It's just like it gets like off on tangents and there's other things come in, like, and that's what's happening with the turnaround agenda and all that kind of stuff.
But I probably should know this, but I'd like to know when that provision was put into the state constitution, yeah, saying that Chicago gets 50%.
Let's continue this. We're going to move on with, yeah, the show, but let's continue this because I'll see if I can get like a scholar or someone. You know, I was thinking about is like Lawrence Massal or somebody to come in who sort of studies the Illinois financial picture and ask them point blank just about the schools and how the school system and funding works. So download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 9, the Chicago Improv Group, the Katydids, will be here. They are premiering their brand new show on TV Land tonight. It's called Teachers, 10 o'clock. This is a group that was at Chicago, played at I.O. and all over town, and they moved to Los Angeles with a web series. Got represented by William Morris Endeavor, landed a gig with to write a pilot and do a pilot for TV Land, and now they've got an engagement that starts tonight. It's part of the new TV Land lineup, so we'll talk with some of the members of the group coming up here at 9 o'clock. And then I'm very excited about this. 10 o'clock, West Side rapper Saba will be here. He has a brand new track that he is dropping tonight. And I just think it's awesome that WGN 720 AM radio is the Chicago premier destination for the new Saba track. Like, I'm just, you know, he's a 21-year-old rapper. He was just on Chance the Rapper's Angels. He performed on Stephen Colbert. And I just picture like a bunch of 20-year-olds. He just tweeted it out, like trying to find AM radio. They don't just like, I'm not even sure where to go, like what I'm supposed to do. They're just, they're like, just weather all the time. Just keep telling me about the traffic times. So we'll talk to Saba coming up at 10 o'clock. Well, coming up next week is Martin Luther King Day, and that means that the Chicago Sinfonietta will be bringing us their annual MLK concert. It's going to be Sunday in Naperville and Monday night at the Symphony Center on Michigan Avenue. This year, the Sinfonietta will offer up a couple of Chicago premieres, including a piece called The Bass Whisperer, co-written by Grammy Award-winning bassist Victor Wooten. It's also written by Connie Ellisor. Wooten will be also playing in the performance. Victor Wooten is considered one of the best bass players in the world. He was named by Rolling Stone as one of the top 10 bassists of all time. We're not talking like top 10 of now. I'm talking of all time. Wooten has 5 Grammys, and when he's not writing concertos, you can see him performing with Bella Fleck and the Flecktones, Stanley Clark, and many, many more. It's my pleasure to welcome musician, teacher, and artist Victor Wooten to The Download. Victor, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Justin. Thanks for having me.
So to talk about the Bass Whisperer, I mean, to be a part of the Sinfonietta here in Chicago, it's a Chicago premiere.
Well, it's a great honor. For one thing, you know, it's not something that an electric bassist or even a double bassist gets to do, to stand up front, you know,
right,
of a symphony and do what we do. So what an honor, but it's also so different for me.
Yeah. Why is it? I mean, obviously it's different, but what drove you to write a piece like this?
Well, for the most part, Connie, you know, my partner in crime, she contacted me and asked me if I, you know, wanted to do a concerto. And my first thought was no. I didn't feel like I was ready to dive into it, you know. But then I thought, you know what, why not? This is, the opportunity's here. And so I called her back and said, yeah, let's do it. I said, but I want to make sure that I can help write it. As much of an honor it would be to have it written for me, I want it to be, you know, to be involved.
So. When you were involved in the process of writing that, how different was it for you? Because, you know, as a bass player and you know, jazz music or folk rock, things like that, you know, that's a pretty standard process of how,
sure,
it kind of works,
sure,
even though you expand it. But how, mm-hmm, hard was it to change your brain to write in that way?
There's some things that are similar and others that are very different. For one that's different is you're writing for different instruments. And you're writing expansive. Like, most of the time, like you mentioned, Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. So if I'm writing a song for that, it's banjo, drums, maybe sax or harmonica, and bass. So we've got 4 guys. You know, but with the symphony, now we're talking about violins. But then there's a second violin. Now there's violas and cellos and basses, and that's just the strings. Then there might be harp. I mean, you know, and of course all the horns and flutes. There's so much to think about. So there's so many more colors that you have to paint with. So that's way different. It's something I had never done before. Now, as a kid, I played cello in the orchestra, so I've been surrounded by that sound, but to write for it is quite different.
Do you think that that background helped you? I mean, obviously, you know, having the understanding of how the symphony works as opposed to being a star bassist who just comes into a symphony surrounding.
It totally helped. There's one thing that's different that most people don't even think about or will never get to experience. Experiencing music from the outside, where you're sitting there listening to it, but from the inside is totally different when you're surrounded by it or even getting to help create it. When you're listening to the music from the inside, it gives you a whole different feeling, different perspective. So having done that, for one, helped me develop my love for this style of music, classical music. But it also gave me a little bit of know-how, a little bit of knowing what's going on, and even knowing the ranges of the instruments. How high or how low can a violin go?
Right.
Versus a cello or a flute, things like that. So, you know, I can't say I was an expert at it all. That's Connie we're talking about. She's the one that really had that know-how. But the part that's similar is it has to start from creativity.
Right.
You have to be able to hear something. You have to be able to come up with a beautiful melody to expand from. And that's the part that I feel comfortable with. But Connie really has the expertise to say, oh, that would sound better in the French horns.
The Chicago Sinfonietta's concerts, the annual Martin Luther King Day concerts. I mean, it's been going on for a while now. I don't know the number of years, but it's been
nice.
You know, and what's it feel like to be a part of that? I mean, you're going to be at Symphony Center. This is the best that Chicago has to offer, and your piece is going to be on stage.
Yeah. Well, again, what a big honor, and to be honoring such an important man in all of our history, what I still call recent history. To be able to pay tribute to that in this day and age, you know, is amazing. I think our country has come a long way that we can even have a holiday for someone like Martin Luther King. But to be able to be a part of the progression of the country, too, in this celebration, it's an honor. And to be able to do it with something that I love to do, which is music, makes it that much more special for me.
Well, it's going to be Sunday afternoon at 3 in Naperville and then Monday night at Symphony Center on Michigan Avenue. Talking with Victor Wooten, his piece Bass Whisperer, which he co-wrote with Connie Ellisor, will be on stage as part of the Chicago Sinfonietta's annual MLK concert and tribute. Let's take a break. When we come back, I'd love to talk to you about your craft, about being a bass player, your work with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. It's amazing to watch. I mean, if anyone is listening and can multitask, go to YouTube, put in Victor Wooten, and you will be – it's like you're just watching – just artistry in motion. Victor Wooten, one of the best bass players living today. We'll talk with him more about his career after the break. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. I could listen to that forever, man. It's just that jazz bass that my guest tonight is a big part of, and he's taken it to a whole other level. Like I said, go to YouTube, put in Victor Wooten, and you can see him on stage. Victor Wooten, a five-time Grammy Award-winning bassist. He plays bass with several artists, Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, but also Stanley Clarke and Marcus Miller, so many different jazz and folk and rock musicians that are notable. A lot of their music has had Victor Wooten's stamp on it. Victor, you know, there's playing bass, and then there's Victor playing bass. I mean, you take it to a whole nother level. A lot of what you do is, you know, create melodies. I mean, you're a one-man band with that instrument. How did you get into the bass, and how did you move it to another level?
Sure. Well, thank you for that first. But I'm the youngest of five brothers that all play music. So when I was born, this sounds like, I always say this sounds like a made-up story, but it's real true. When I was born, my older brothers already knew they needed a bass player.
Literally. True, right?
So I've been playing my
Mom, make us a bass player, right?
That's it. Exactly right. Mom and Dad. Yeah. So I've been playing my whole life. Literally, when I was 1, 2 years old, my brothers would sit down to jam, and they would leave a space for me. And I would just make noise with them. But I was learning a whole lot. It's sort of like a baby doing baby talk.
Right.
You know, the baby's in the room. The baby's going to join the conversation. It may not be real words yet, but the communication is real. You know, the parent knows everything the baby's meaning, you know. And so I was learning that. And when I was a little older, and I mean just a little older, 3 or 4, my older brother, Reggie, who's only 8 years older than me, he's my oldest brother. He started really teaching me where to put my fingers.
Wow.
To play songs. But the cool thing is I already knew these songs he was showing me. So learning to play them. Though I always equate it to how a baby learns the words that are necessary for them first. Like when they learn to say milk or more, they already know what that is.
Right.
You know?
So they just need to learn to communicate it.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. With what we call English. They're communicating it anyway, their own way. So I was learning now where to place my fingers to play songs, you know, from the late 60s, early 70s, that I was already hearing. And so by the time I was five, literally five, the five of us boys, ranging from age 5 to 13, were on tour throughout the West Coast, opening for a great soul singer named Curtis Mayfield.
All right, first off, you're in Chicago. You know, I would hope everybody who's listening right now knows who Curtis Mayfield is.
Yeah,
I had no idea. I mean, to open up for Curtis Mayfield at five years old.
I've
heard stories. That's a story.
It's pretty amazing.
Amazing.
I look back at it now because I have young kids, and I see how amazing it was. But to us at that time, it's just what we did. We played music, you know.
What kind of music were you playing? Was it
soul?
Soul?
Yeah. A lot of the times it was just... You know, Motown was around at that time. It was before pop music was in style of music. Pop just meant popular. So whatever was on the pop radio at the time was everything. You know, of course, we had jazz stations and things like that, but the pop stations played everything.
Right.
And we were tuned into that. So it meant some rock. Of course, the Beatles were around, Jackson 5, James Brown, Temptations, and things like that. So we were a cover band.
Let me ask you, but I mean, from doing that, especially at such a young age, I mean, you learn so much about being a musician.
Yeah.
Because you had to work. I mean, right. You're working at five. Mm-hmm. But what did you learn about, what did you learn about life, and what made you want to become a full-time musician?
Well, it was so just natural that I didn't realize what I was learning. Now, becoming what's called a teacher. You know, I'm fortunate I get to go around and teach now. I look back at what I had learned because I see other people, other musicians who maybe didn't grow up like I did, and they may not have some of the skills. And that's not ego talking. I just realize the differences. It's like someone growing up speaking English as a baby and then someone who's learning as a second language.
Right.
You know, so it was the same type of thing. I was doing it so natural and so young that I didn't think about it. It's just what we did. But there are so many things that you learn on the stage, like you doing radio. You can practice for it, but there's some things you won't learn until you're on the air,
right?
And you're doing it, and you're making mistakes, and you got to file, you got to read something, you can't find the paper, you know. So I know you're smart.
You must be a regular listener. That's good.
But there's so many things that I learn. A lot of music in a band, anyway, is about how you relate to and communicate with the band members. And then put them in front of an audience. Now you have a whole bunch more people to relate to. And those are things that I learned as a youngster. So I really learned about performance also.
At what point we're talking about you on tour at 5 years old. I mean, you're getting an education that most musicians have never heard of. I mean, to be on tour with Curtis Mayfield.
Right.
At what point in your life, you know, when you're a little older, maybe you're, you know, in your teens, did you realize that professionally you wanted to evolve and be a professional musician?
Yeah, I think it was around 8th or 9th grade because 3 of my older brothers actually went to a few years of college and they dropped out with our parents' blessing. And it was around that time that it dawned on me that I can just play music and that's my job. You know, I had been doing it literally my whole life. It was so natural. It was like working on the farm. You don't expect to grow up and be a professional farmer. You know, I didn't think I would be a professional musician. I can literally remember as a kid thinking I was going to be a fireman or a policeman. And that's what kids wanted to be in the 60s and 70s. So when I was eighth or ninth grade, I said, well, I can really keep doing this. That's when it dawned on me. Wow, I'm going to be a musician for the rest of my life. And there were blessings and curses that came with it.
Well, let's take a break for the news. We come back. I'd love to talk more about those blessings and those curses.
Sure.
And also about the transition from being a traditional bass player, which, you know, has always been rhythm and bass. You know, you guys are in the back and the singers are in the front.
Right.
To a show in which you're in the front, you know, where this is the people are coming to pay tickets to watch you play bass. Victor Wooten, five-time Grammy Award winner, his new work, Bass Whisperer is going to be at the Chicago Sinfonietta on Sunday in Naperville, Monday at the Symphony Center as part of the Chicago Sinfonietta's annual MLK concert. We come back more with Victor Wooten here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Victor Wooten, named by Rolling Stone as one of the top 10 bassists of all time.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do they know?
What do they know, right? Victor is bringing his new piece, Bass Whisperer, to the Chicago Sinfonietta concert that's going to be honoring Martin Luther King. It's the annual concert that Chicago Sinfonietta does Sunday in Naperville, Monday in Chicago at the Symphony Center. You know, we were just talking about your life and amazing experiences at such a young age to be opening for Curtis Mayfield playing. You know, as you got into adulthood and recognized you're going to be a professional musician, I would just assume that your skills were so advanced, it must have been hard to find musicians to play with.
Well, I grew up playing in a band with my brothers. So at least the first half of my life, we were a five-piece band. Like, people know how I learned, which is from my brothers, but how my brother learned, like Reggie, who taught me to play bass, taught Joseph to play keys, who taught him? That's the real, like, the real credit gets, for in my head, goes there. So I always had them to play with, and they are some of the best musicians in the world. So playing with them was always my motivation, you know. But for my age, I was maybe a little bit more advanced than other musicians, but I had my brothers to play with.
So when you got older and you know, you started branching out, you know, I said, okay, where would you find musicians? You're not putting an ad in a Craigslist, looking for a band that can match my skills. Oh, by the way, I've been playing since five, opening for Curtis Mayfield. I mean, where do you find the musicians to play?
Yeah, well, good question. Through a bad record deal in the early '80s, the five of us brothers found ourselves not playing together steadily anymore. Couple of the brothers were in New York. The rest of us were in Virginia where we were living. And so to not have to get a regular job, a few of us started working at an amusement park, Busch Gardens in Williamsburg, Virginia. And so we got in some of the musical acts. I was actually hired there as a bluegrass fiddle player. And I literally, my brother Roy got me the job. I had never played bluegrass fiddle. I had never played fiddle in my life. But I had seen a violin in my, you know, high school orchestra. So I borrowed one and just started practicing. And I started playing fiddle at this park, and I realized I had to learn how to play with other musicians. I had been playing with only my brothers. And now I'm sort of like in another musical household where people react different. Good musicians, but, you know, you have to relate to them.
Right.
And things were different. And I realized that through that bad experience record label thing that really pulled the brothers' band apart, the good part is it made me a better musician because now I learned how to play with other people. And that was kind of the start. And it was through that bluegrass band at the amusement park that I found out about this banjo player living in Nashville. And that's how I met Bela Fleck, and one thing led to the other.
So you know, obviously, Bela Fleck and the Flecktones has just been an amazing band that has stood the test of time, won a ton of Grammys.
Yeah.
What's your process like with that band? I mean, you collaborate, you continue to work, but what was the process like when you met him and started working with the band?
Yeah, well, I visited a friend in Nashville, Tennessee, who knew Bela. He introduced us, and I went to Bela's house, and we just had a jam session, just him and me in his kitchen, and we just musically hit it off. And personally hit it off. And then soon after, he asked me to be a part of a television show. And he was looking for a drummer, and I told him about my brother. And then Howard Levy, great harmonica player,
yeah, of
keyboard
course.
Player. So we got together with the hopes of doing one show, the plan of doing one show. But it went so well. I mean, we barely got a chance to rehearse, and the show was amazing. We knew it was something special. It was a new sound. So we kept doing it. You know, and 20-something, close to 30 years later, we're still doing
Well, you guys show up all the time. I mean, I just had someone text in and said, I can't believe you have Victor on. I just saw him at Ravinia.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you obviously have a huge fan base for the band, but it's not all you do. I mean, because, doing work with Stanley Clark, I mean, right. you have found a way to not only be a part of such a, I would say, a progressive band and Bela Fleck band, but to take bass playing from the back line to the front line.
Well, I'm very fortunate. For one, having the upbringing that my brothers gave me musically, I was able to see music and my instrument differently. You know, the bass is not limited. The musician is limited or not. And so when I would see my brother playing guitar, I would want to make my bass do that. I was learning drum licks from my brother, but playing them on the bass. I would literally give my brother Joseph the bass and say, play this like a piano. And he would lay it down and I would see two hands on it. And I said, wow, we can put two hands on the neck. Then I realized that you take a saxophone and if you were to lay it sideways, it looks just like you're playing a guitar. And so fortunately, as a youngster, I was able to see that. So I stole or borrowed, you could say, from my brothers way early. And so I was playing and experimenting with different things early on.
Well, you said it. I mean, the instrument's not limited, the artist is.
Right.
But in your case, I mean, it's so interesting because the bass, talk about the craft, you know, it does serve as sort of the rhythm section.
Right. It
still needs to do that.
Right.
You found a way to expand that, to add melody, to really push the boundaries of what that instrument can do.
Yeah, but I had good examples first. I had good shoulders to stand on. You mentioned Stanley Clark, Marcus Miller. These guys came before me.
Yeah.
So I grew up listening to them. And then, of course, Jaco Pastorius. But even going further back, the bass players that played with people like Curtis Mayfield or any of those guys. So you have James Jamerson, Chuck Rennie, Bob Babbitt, Duck Dunn. These great guys that really created, the fabric of the whole soundtrack to my upbringing were these players. When I was young, I didn't know their names, but I learned them all as I got older. The song you played as we were coming in is a song called The Bass Tribute, and that was a song I wrote to pay tribute to all of these heroes, even the people I didn't even know their names. A lot of times we get tributed after we die, and I wanted to say thank you while a lot of my heroes were still alive. And so I did a song like that, and I'm saying that to say there's a lot of shoulders that I'm standing on, mm-hmm. so I haven't done it myself, on my own.
Well, we mentioned earlier in the interview about you playing cello when you were younger in symphony, and it gave you a better understanding of how the symphony works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting because as electric, when we talk about bass, there's stand-up bass, there's the electric bass.
Mm-hmm.
You see a lot of the stand-up bass stuff in jazz music. I mean, obviously the classic and even contemporary, that seems to be but your music and others have taken the electric bass and adapted it to contemporary jazz music and given it a whole new sound. Do you prefer to? I mean, it's such a strange question, but mm-hmm. genre-wise,
yeah.
do you consider yourself a jazz artist?
Well, I really, if I had to choose one, I'm really like an R&B soul music bass player that fakes his way through jazz and is really faking his way through this classical stuff now, right? But because the fabric of my upbringing came through Motown and James Brown and Sly Stone and that kind of stuff. The 60s, late 60s
right.
and 70s, when we had access to lots of different styles of music. So that's really how I consider myself. But I love playing jazz. I love the freedom of jazz to improvise the same way we're talking right now.
Well, it seems because when you see your stuff or listen to your stuff, I mean, there does that spirit comes out, that sure. improvisation, that freedom that mm-hmm. you're using a lot of what jazz music has pushed forward for so long.
Right.
You're using that. That's your influence.
Right. And to play that music, you have to have a certain level of understanding of your instrument, yourself, and the music, which is why a lot of the times, and classical the same way, which is why if you play your instrument long enough, you're going to find yourself dabbling in jazz and classical because of the high level that it takes to live in that world. And so I'm very, very fortunate that I get to dabble in a lot of different things, you know. And mentioning the cello, being an electric bass player, our notes are usually rhythmic and short, but I've always had a longing for that long note, the bowed note. And so what I'll be playing with the symphony is a brand new instrument that I call the bow bass. I've had an idea for literally 20 years that I got made just a year ago for this piece, the Bass Whisper. And it's an electric bass that I hold like an electric bass, but I can bow it to make it sound like a cello or a bass.
That's look where you're at. You're making new instruments. You're past the music now. You're like, the music's old hat. Now you need to start making new instruments.
When you hear it, you have to find a way to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you stick with the sound enough, you'll find a way to do it.
Let me ask you, you've made a transition to being a teacher.
Sure.
And, you know, you've talked a lot about your brothers and how your brothers have had taught you. And right. a lot of it was like, put your hand here and put your hand there.
Right.
You know, kids who might be listening to you right now sure. or, you know, bass players who want to expand their craft. As a teacher, what do you tell people who say, I want to be a bass player?
Right. Well, I go back to what my mom says, and I say this to all the musicians. My mom would tell us boys, she would ask us a question. She would say, what does the world need with just another good musician? Because we were spending hours practicing. And she was making us look at why. She said, what does the world need with just another good musician? She said, we have plenty. She said, what the world needs is good people. So it really made us to look at and find a way to make all this time spent doing something make us better people so that the world is better. And that sounds like a parent or a mom talking, but it's accurate. You know, so I really... look at that and try to get younger students to look at that because your ability on the instrument may open a door, but who you are as that person is either going to keep that door open or get you thrown out of the room because it is about relationships. If we're on tour, we get to play music a couple hours a day, but we're riding on a plane or a tour bus or hanging out the rest of the day, and who we are as people is really the important thing. Who you are off of the instrument is more important than who you are on the instrument.
Victor Wooten, pleasure, man. Just
Thank
a
you.
Pleasure to talk to you.
I appreciate it, Justin.
A long time, as we said, Rolling Stone, because you're one of the best bass players of all time, 5-time Grammy Award winner, plays with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, but also Stanley Clark, his own music, Marcus Miller, all the way down the line of all the great bass players. And now I know when he was 5 years old, opened for Curtis Mayfield. amazing to talk to you. The show, the Chicago Sinfonietta show, which is the annual show, the Martin Luther King Day show,
right.
Is going to be Sunday in Naperville, and then on Monday it's going to be at the Symphony Center here in Chicago.
Cool.
And your piece, Bass Whisperer, is a Chicago premiere.
Yeah.
Will be a part of that show. Victor, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for speaking with me, Jess.
How great. You know, like the idea that you'd be 5 years old. I mean, I can't tell you, Pete, like how many people we have on this program on the download who sit at the big table and they're just so talented.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're here. I mean, they've obviously succeeded in the arts or they've succeeded in whatever they do. They wrote a great book or they've done something with that talent. And then when you start talking to them, you recognize quickly that this is something that is special. I mean, can you imagine being 5 years old, like on tour with your brothers, and doing soul music and opening for Curtis Mayfield?
No.
It's not even I don't know. It's just amazing.
Yeah, like you were saying before the show, we're just kind of going down the rabbit hole of watching videos of that guy.
Amazing.
Yeah, you just can't stop. You start and you just can't stop because Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, and you really should check it out if you just go to YouTube and check out Victor Wooten. One of the great things that he can do on the bass is he can essentially do a whole song. So, like, one of them, you see him, like, it must be one of his go-tos on the tour, but he does Isn't She Lovely, Stevie Wonder.
Nice.
Yeah, but he does it on the bass. Boom, 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 doom, 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 doom. Like, he does every part of it. Anyway, it's great. It's amazing. And again, you know, and one of the things I love about the big table and being able to talk to artists at length is you start to see a lot of the same answers from different people in different disciplines, different areas, different mediums. But there, it's interesting, like what he said about teaching, you know, about it's not what you do on the instruments, what you do off. You know, you'd be a good person, not just a good musician. Well, Mick Napier, who was from the Annoyance Theater, you know, that was a big part of our conversation about, you know, when you're doing improvisation, it's not just about how great you are on stage. It's about how you act off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting. I mean, when you hear that, and especially when it's as much as music, you can throw a stone and hit a musician. That's a small community, especially ones at that level that are touring and all the different people that you're working with, constantly collaborating with. If you're an ass, you're probably not going to be in that world for too long.
Yeah.
It's interesting, you know. He was great. It was a great conversation. I'm happy he was here. That's one of those that we should share, and hopefully people would want to, anyone who's interested in what goes through the mind of a musician. It's great.
One of the greatest in the world.
Yeah, right? How do you get top 10 of anything?
Chicago.
It's not even of a year. I thought it was like a year.
Yeah.
When I looked at closer, I'm like, the top 10 bassists of 2013, which I think is a funny list. BuzzFeed's top 10 bassists of 2014. No, they were just saying across the board, this is just like, I mean, that's amazing to think about. And the ones that he mentioned, too. Like the ones that he paid tribute, whether it be Stanley Clarke. Because Stanley Clarke is amazing. If you get a chance, if bass is not your thing. And I'm not saying it's mine, but I know enough about musicianship and jazz, and I worked a lot on jazz programming at the public radio station, and I directed some jazz festivals here in town, so I know a lot about jazz music. I wouldn't say I'm an aficionado. I have a great story where I might have told – I forget which ones I've told on the air, so I forget.
All right.
But there's a great story where a friend of mine who I worked with that I looked up to, he was a jazz guy at WBEZ, and I was really into jazz. I was really getting, I was 21, 22 years old. I was really getting into it. So I was all this, and I really was attracted to sort of a late 70s jazz music. So Ramsey Lewis, Miles Davis had, you know, where he kind of went off the rails a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Stanley Clarke is in that combo. So it's like a real sort of like adding of electric sound. So it's not just a doom, 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 doom. They're adding a lot of fusion. There's just like a real experimental time. So I go to the Jazz Record Mart right over here. And I'm like, okay, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna walk around and act like, you know, put my turtleneck on and walk around and try to find the CDs when they were sold in the huge tall plastic packaging. This is even before that, it was just cardboard, you know. And I'm trying to find the Ramsey Lewis that I'm thinking about. And I'm thinking about the one where, and I forget the name of the record, which is one of the best records of all time, where his face, it's just like gold, so it's spread across, and it's like all the stuff that's unbelievable at Ramsey Lewis, late 70s. So I'm like trying to find that stuff, and I'm trying to find that record, but I'm kind of new at it. I run into this guy, the guy I worked with at WBEC. And I'm like, hey, you're one of the jocks. Like, you know, maybe you can help me. And he's like, I got the thing for you, kid. You know, and he goes and he pulls out one, and it's, of course, he's got to pull out the 1899 disc, you know, not the 699 that I was looking for. And it's a picture of Ramsey Lewis, like, on the front of the thing, like, playing the classic piano. And Ramsey's got the suit on, and he's young, and I'm like, well, that's not. I'm looking for more big glasses, afro. You know, I'm now wearing a shirt, kind of Ramsey Lewis, not a suit like Hang on Sloopy or whatever. What it was, not Hang on Sloopy, but that kind of thing. And hilarious. I'm like, all right, well, he knows. I told him what I wanted, right? So I go up. I think I've barely got the money. I go home. I put it on. It's like classic 1950s the piano, and I'm like, what is this? I scroll through track 2, 3 all the way to 16, and it's just all the same 50s piano. And I open up the thing and I start looking, and I open up the liner notes, written by that guy that worked at WBEZ with me.
Oh, man.
He, like, sold me his liner notes.
Yeah.
When I didn't want any of that. And I was like, that's it. I'm done with jazz.
You just gave up on it for that reason?
I was like, that's it. You had a chance with me. I could have been the biggest jazz supporter. Right? I could have, right now, the show on the download, the jazz download.
Yeah.
Could have been all jazz. But that guy, he ruined it.
Oh, man. That guy.
18, 9, he owes me 12 bucks. I was looking, and when I finally found that Ramsey Lewis record, yeah, it was like $6.
Yeah.
$5.99.
Oh, man. What a jerk.
You said it, buddy. I remind him when I see that, too. When I see him, I'm always like, hey, where's my money?
You still have? Did you like take the record to the resale shop? Where you still
that
have that
one's
in your
gone?
Collection?
That one, no, that one's gone. That Ramsey Lewis is gone. It was like a best of Ramsey Lewis from the '50s. I could get that anywhere. The one, the God, why am I blanking on the name of the record? But the record that I found, the '70s record, has been a huge part of my musical background for the last 30 years.
Really?
I listen to it all the time. Deo, ba-ba-be-o.
Nice.
There's some great songs on that. This Ramsey, we need to get Ramsey Lewis in here.
I was going to say Chicago.
He lives
has
in Chicago. I don't know if he still. I mean, he was on WNUA and he did all this stuff back in the day. But
I'm sure, he's around.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if he's not smart, he's probably in the Florida
warm
for
weather. But Chicago has a very vibrant jazz
absolutely
community,
yep,
that I'm really not familiar with. But I, you know, I hang around musician types on occasion, and you know, I hear about it secondhand.
Yeah.
And, you know, so.
Well, there's an underground jazz. There's an alternative jazz movement, Vandermark, and the AACM. Those guys have been making music, great Chicago music, for years, and they usually will get some sort of tribute at the jazz festival. The mainstream jazz, I mean, that's kind of a weird oxymoron because jazz is not in the mainstream anymore. But the people who might go through the jazz showcase are fewer and further between. Orbert Davis is a great trumpet player here in Chicago. And he, I don't even know if he's here. I haven't heard much from him. I haven't really been paying. I almost would make the argument that iTunes and the advent of the iPhone destroyed jazz, because there used to be almost a thing that you would go to the record store and try to get an album and listen to eight tracks.
Whole track. Yeah,
yeah, and it's harder. I found it harder as a consumer to be able to go out and find that one track on, you know, go to the jazz section on iTunes and understand what's good and what's not.
Yeah.
Because it's just not the same experience. But anyway, amazing.
Yeah.
To have, I mean, Victor Wooten in here to talk that stuff, I would do it all night. It's awesome.
I think really the only thing I know about Chicago jazz is that I know that Amy Schumer's brother plays it in town.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's what he's doing here?
Yeah.
I mean, there's still clubs that do it. I mean, the Green Mill, you know, and the Constellation.
Of course, yeah.
And what's the place that that Mars Williams was talking about. I forgot the name of the place. There's another club. There's Jazz Showcase. There's some clubs on the south side that still dabble in it.
Yeah.
But,
get,
I mean, it's amazing.
Get that going.
I think, if the audience is interested, I mean, we could get jazz musicians in here all the time. I feel like there's
a couple on the street.
There are. There's a guy, a Peeble Bryson fan, right here on Michigan Avenue in the summer. It's like a home.
The guy playing the Home Depot bucket does not constitute jazz.
No, this guy's got a, I guess it's a sax, and he does A Whole New World. And he plays it out here right in front of our office, and he just plays it over and over and over. I think he takes like 20-minute breaks.
Yeah.
But the tourists are just walking past, so they don't know. But you and I, Pete, we know.
Yeah, we hear that.
Because we hear it all afternoon.
So he's a union sax guy.
Yeah, he's a union sax guy.
I'll take my 20-minute break now. I'll be back.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tonight, a new show debuts on TV Land. It's called Teachers, and it's a comedy about a set of teachers at Fillmore Elementary School. But it's definitely not a show about the state of education in this country.
Okay, everyone, quiet coyote. Thank you. Now, today I want to talk to you guys about bullies. A bully is someone who generally disregards your feelings, ignores your texts, and changes the password on your joint Netflix account 2 days after you break up.
Miss Watson.
A bully can also take you to Nashville one weekend on his frequent flyer miles, treat you to bottomless mimosas, and then on Monday tell you it's over.
What's a mimosa?
It's something women in their 20s order so they can feel better about drinking in the morning.
I thought we were going to read Cinderella today.
No. No, I'm not going to be reading you any fairy tales because they're lies. The truth is, kids,
Sometimes Prince Charming wants to date other people, you know? And just because you leave a shoe at his apartment doesn't mean you can show up whenever you want. Nobody lives happily ever after. Trust me, my cousin Connie's 39. She just got divorced, and now she works part-time at a Chico's.
Chico's?
Yeah, Chico's. Spanish for big shoulders.
Or is it? It's a new show based on a successful web series of the same name, produced and starring the Chicago improv group Katie Dids. The group currently lives in L.A., but they got their start right here at I.O. in Chicago. In studio with me tonight, Katie Thomas, Kate Lambert, and Caitlin Barlow. The show debuts tonight at 10 o'clock. Thanks for being here.
Oh, my gosh. Thanks for having us. We're so excited.
What's going through your head right now? I mean, this has been such a journey for you guys. I mean, it's about to debut.
Oh, my gosh. My husband's back in LA, and he texted me this afternoon and said, how are you feeling? And I think I sent him 12 texts back saying different emotions. I was like, proud, nervous, anxious, happy, excited, nostalgic. I mean, it was just this barrage of...
They have emojis for that stuff now. You can just...
I know. Send... I know.
Just the one that has your hands in the air, like, I'm not sure how to feel.
So, I mean, it's just amazing because it really is, if you think about... all the way back to Chicago when you guys met and started performing improv and said, hey, we really like the chemistry. Okay, well, let's do something together. Let's do a web series. I know, let's go to LA. Let's sell this web series. Okay, now it's a TV show. I mean, it's almost like the improv group dream.
It is.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, we're just so excited. The thing is that, you know, we obviously started as an improv group. Caitlin actually put the group together. I'll let her tell the story, though.
Sure. I mean, yeah, we all met 8 years ago. We're all in the Chicago comedy scene. And I just kept meeting all these really funny women named Kate or Katie. Mm-hmm. And so kind of just as a joke, I was like, let's do an improv show. We all have the same name. And it was just supposed to be one show, but we did. I mean, we just had amazing chemistry and we became best friends. And, you know, I think something that's really cool about this group is that we're all very different. We all have different strengths. But, you know, when we all come together, it kind of creates this different voice. That's all of our voices together, and it's something kind of outside of ourselves.
Well, you guys have, you know, done improv for a long time now. How important is that? I mean, for people who are maybe not familiar with the art form, how important is it to have diverse talent on stage, not everybody, you know, being the same?
Very important. I mean, the thing is that you want people who have different strengths and different things with improv. Improv has so many different, like, characteristics of it. You know, someone who is not afraid to be physical or someone who's not afraid to be wacky. And, like, you just need someone. But the thing is about this group is that I think sometimes when you put improv groups together, you can focus so much on that. Like, okay, this person fills that slot. This person fills that slot. Yeah. And that this group was put so together, like, and we all have the same name. But somehow it worked out. And so because we all do have different strengths, so it was just sort of like kismet. Like, it doesn't make sense. It probably shouldn't have worked, but it did. And, you know, like, some of us didn't even know each other. We shook hands before we walked out on stage that night. But after we performed, we started at Playground, and then we did a run at Studio B. And it was really during that run at Studio B, because we had done it, like, a bunch of times every week, where we, after the Playground and then after the Studio B, we're like, okay, something is different about mm-hmm. this. And it just felt so special that we decided that we had to run with it.
Let me ask you, I mean, there's always a time where chemistry will play and you feel like you get a good show, especially in the Chicago improv community. But there's that moment where you say, well, we can make a life out of this, or we can make a business, because the business really gears itself towards individuals. I mean, that's just the way it is. And being in comedy, you can be in groups, but you get to the next stage and they're like, we like you. We don't, not as much you. You know, like, that's down the line. When did you decide this is something we're going to do together and this is going to be our lives?
Well, I think after that Studio B run, some IO folks had come to the show and decided they wanted to give us a slot at their theater. And it was in that moment that we just started, we almost attacked it like a business in that moment. We decided, Kate Lambert suggested we make some promo videos to promote the show. We got a photographer to take some really fun promo photos of us. We sent out press releases. I mean, it was a midnight on a Friday night show at IO, you know?
We decided to brand ourselves right away.
Yeah.
We got a logo, we got a website, we got, you know, a Facebook fan page. And the whole reason behind the promo videos was people might not know our comedy or know maybe our faces, but we were like, we'll put our faces out there and we'll show people what kind of comedy we do, so maybe they'll be interested in coming to the improv show. And, like, that's how we could get attendance and our kind of comedy that we do and our brand out there.
Right. And so then from there, it just seemed like the girls were saying about this kind of unique voice that comes out of us when the six of us come together. There was just something so unique and special about that. We just wanted to really stick with that. And yeah, I mean, there are a lot of individuals that have come out of Chicago, and we really admire people who have all ended up on SNL. It's Cecily Strong, Edie Bryant, Vanessa Bayer, all those guys. And I think, you know, we were all doing our own work on our own, but this was the thing that just seemed to keep working time and time again.
Well, let me ask you about the web series, because that's really where, you know, you see the kernel of what you've done with Teachers on TV Land, which we'll see tonight at 10 o'clock. The web series, you know, you got together with Matt Miller, who's a longtime casting director and a producer here in Chicago, to create this web series. How did that come about?
Matt Miller is lovely, and he's wonderful. He's a wonderful man.
Very
tall man. Basically, what happened was we were developing another web series about a mega church, and we really wanted to work with Matt because we knew him. And we approached him with a project, and he's like, I don't think this is quite right, but we knew that we wanted to work together. So Matt came to us, and he said, you know, I think it would be really funny if you all play teachers. And so we're like, all right. So we worked together, and we collaborated, and the KDDids developed these characters, and we wrote
24.
We wrote 24 episodes, and we were so lucky to collaborate with Matt and also get together with Capgun Collective in Chicago, mm-hmm. which really, they all those guys absolutely elevated the project.
Did you have a background in any sort of education? I mean, were you familiar with the concept of being a teacher?
Yes. I have my master's degree in bilingual education from DePaul, and I was a Chicago public school teacher.
There you go.
I taught fourth grade at Hibbert Elementary in Albany Park.
Hello.
Hello, if any of you
are listening. Well, how about the rest of you? I mean, was it more like, okay, I know the stereotype of teachers, and I mean, the premise is that, you know, you're teachers, but you're kind of disaffected. That's the concept. Like, that, I mean, I don't want to give away the complete comedy, but you guys are kind of in your own world as the school day kind of moves around you. But how much did you know about what a teacher does or how a teacher acts?
Well, in that first meeting, we actually hadn't nailed down at what level we wanted to teach at. And we decided elementary school because elementary school is such like a crisp memory for everybody. I think I can remember every single name of my elementary school teachers. Like, you know, they were just something that they're people that just influence you and your education forever. And we thought that it would just be such a great thing because it's such a nostalgia surrounding it. And there are so many things like you learn about holidays. You learn about, you know, like there's all those different like picture day, field day, sex ed. Like there are so many like huge like moments in elementary school. So that's, I think, why we essentially went after that. But then also we decided that elementary school kids, it'll sort of fly over their heads a little bit when we're really inappropriate. But also they'll be honest. Like, they'll be like, I don't think you're handling this breakup very well. Right. And it's like, I'm sorry, what? You know? Like,
well, there's a great scene in one of the episodes where you are putting up on the screen your Facebook pictures of your ex.
Yeah.
And does this look like they're serious? And
yeah, friends are more than friends.
No, like, it's a great scene. And when one of the kids goes, that looks pretty serious, get out.
Yeah. Like, it's a great, time for you to leave. Because that is the wrong answer.
But I mean, it's funny because I have an 8-year-old. We're in an elementary school in the Chicago Public Schools, and the teachers are younger. I mean, they're 20, in their early 20s, mid 20s. And there is this sort of like feel that maybe, you know, like maybe this isn't like the educator of the past where it's like, this is all I do and this is my life. No, they're kids.
Yeah. But were the educators of the past?
No, they probably weren't.
You know, I think like that's part of what we really liked about this idea was that, you know, that memory of those elementary school teachers when you're a kid is that they only exist in that world. It's exactly that. Oh, they only teach and they're married and they go home and they do their thing and that's it.
They're
and when
pure.
You're a kid, like one of the girls in the group mentioned that one of her teachers got married during a school year and her last name changed and it blew her mind. Katie O'Brien always says that it's like seeing a dinosaur when you see a purple dinosaur when you see a teacher outside of the classroom. And I think what we really found interesting was that this is a workplace comedy and these are real people, just like teachers are real people. They've got stuff going on. They have hangovers sometimes. It's just that they're held to this totally different standard because they're in charge of molding the minds of America's youth.
And that's a great juxtaposition to play against.
Yeah, and also, like, I mean, I think we can all say, like, in our early 20s, we didn't know what we were doing.
Uh-uh.
And the fact that you're in charge of molding America's youth, it's like, you can't even figure out how to get, you know, rid of a hangover.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those things where it's like you show up and you're like, because kids think adults have it all figured out. It's like, listen, I have no idea what's going on either. You know? Like, I don't even know.
Kate Lambert, Katie Thomas, Caitlin Barlow are three of the six members of the Katie Dids. Their show, Teachers, debuts tonight at 10 o'clock on TV Land. We're going to take a break. We come back. I want to talk about how you guys got this to TV. I mean, the idea of a web series to TV almost feels like it's just a line in a story, you know, where they always say, and then they had a web series and they were found. But it's not that true. If you really look at it, web series have a high failure rate of when they get pushed to television. You guys made it through. We'll talk more with you guys about how you did that here on The Download. Stay with us.
So I went out with a drug dealer. Jared S., make a better choice. Saturday night. It was incredible.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. We're talking about the show Teachers, which debuts tonight, 10 o'clock on TV Land. In studio with me, Katie Thomas, Kate Lambert, and Caitlin Barlow. They are three of the six members of the Katie Dids, an improv group that started here in Chicago. They now live in Los Angeles. You guys made that decision, though. That was a decision that was made. You were here in Chicago. You said, you know what, for us in our career, let's all move to Los Angeles.
Yeah, we kind of trickled out there. Katie O'Brien has been there the longest, and we didn't all, you know, it wasn't like there was a TV show in place at that point. We started working with William Morris Endeavor when most of us were still living in Chicago. So we started working with them to sell the show. We flew out there for a lot of meetings. A lot of us were still living here. And slowly but surely, we started moving out there. And by the time we sold a pilot, that's when the last few of us went
out
there.
Said, we got to get out there,
yeah. Yeah, you know, and I think that for some of us, that was a huge risk. I mean, Caitlin was still teaching at Hibbert Elementary, holla, you know, and she loved that job. And my husband had a job here, and he believed in it so much that he came out to LA with me. So, you know, we knew we were going to write, produce, and shoot a pilot and star in it, and that's all we knew.
It was a huge, huge leap of faith.
Yeah.
It's interesting because you could continue to do the go to LA, fly, come back, you know, do that kind of thing. What was it about the leap of faith that said, you know what, this is the moment, we're gonna uproot and move to Los Angeles?
I think for me, it was just, you know, I loved my job. I loved my school. And it was hard. It was a very, very hard decision to make. But it was just, I knew that this was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And this group was so important to me. And it was so important to take this group as far as I could take it. So for me, it was kind of, you know, as soon as we knew the pilot was happening, for me, it was hard, but it was kind of, I knew what the right decision was. Yeah.
That process is a process that is wrought with a lot of mystery, you know, for people who aren't in the business, to how you get from web series to the pitch room to pilot to TV Land to actually a premiere tonight. Talk about that. I mean, because you went out with the idea of having, you know, the actual physical, the web series in your hand. What was the reaction? How did you get it to the next step?
Well, when we released the web series, it got some traction pretty quickly. And so when William Morris came on, we started, you know, obviously thinking about getting it to television. And Allison Brie was looking for, looked to get on the production side. And she was brought onto the project. We met with her and we just thought she was a terrific fit for it. And we were planning on going out to pitch everything. And TV Land actually called William Morris and was like, we are looking for a comedy.
Yeah.
And Teachers fit the bill. And so William Morris, I'm talking about William Morris, like he actually showed it to him. Yeah. Our agent at William Morris, Alec Botnick, he actually, you know, sent it over to them. And that's how they bought it.
It's interesting because you have, it's almost like, you know, the advantage that you have is that you've already produced this in some way that they could see. A lot of times, you know, before the internet, I mean, comics had to just go into a room and be like, then the camera goes down a hallway and then you see two teachers, you know, and you have to explain it that way, almost like in a face-to-face. You had the physical jokes, the great production, the web series in your hand.
We had a digital pitch, yeah, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always been the Katie Dids MO, is just do it ourselves. Because, you know, we're here in Chicago, there's limited opportunities, there's tons of improvisers all vying for the same thing. And instead of just kind of waiting around, we did it ourselves, and that's what we did with the web series. As opposed to saying, like, can I please pitch this to you, Mr. Executive? We had proof that it was going to work. And TV Land has been a dream come true to work with. I mean, I can't imagine us having the amount of creative control at any other place.
Well, I was going to ask. Yeah. I mean, you went from being in control of your product at the web series where there really wasn't a higher boss to now, you know, a network that has a lot of interest in. I'm sure there's more involvement. How has that been for you guys?
It's been wonderful. I mean, I think that, you know, my personal opinion is the best comedy comes from TV networks saying, express yourself.
We trust you.
Yeah, we trust you. Absolutely. And so that's how TV Land has been. The majority of notes that we've gotten from them has been, go further. Make this your voice. This must be your voice for it to be the best it can be. And I pinch myself every day because you hear all these horror stories about, you know, comedians having to change their vision. And that was never the case with TV Land.
No, like the characters, I think, and the notes that they gave made everything sharper and work better. And so they constantly would be like, we want what the web series was in a TV show.
How much do you go and take the jokes that you had and transfer them to the I mean, because it's a different experience, obviously, from, you know, having an improv background and doing that web series to actually writing pilots and episodes and putting things together. How's that transition been for you guys?
Well, I think the thing that was most important for us was to take these characters and these vignettes that we had and just make them a little bit bigger and sharper in the sense that we needed to explore these women in a half-hour format as opposed to 2 minutes and 30 seconds. So some of the characters got more 3D, and, you know, we sort of differentiated between them more. So they just became more defined. And, you know, things like the web series, we do have bits from the web series that now we are able to explore. You know, like Friends Are More Than Friends, like that you mentioned earlier.
Right.
That's now an episode. And so that's something that she's dealing with.
Arc, right.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's like we showed you, like, pieces of stuff that could have been bigger from the web series, and so we got the chance to explore that with everybody's different characters.
It was a wonderful learning experience because none of us came from a TV writing background.
Right.
We're sketch writers.
How did you do that? Do you bring other writers in, like,
so,
that's kind of know that?
Actually, the six Katydids are the authors on all the scripts.
We
broke
great.
It. We would break the story as the six of us
with our showrunners, G. Martell and Ian Roberts,
who are the showrunners.
Huge showrunners,
Key and Peele, and
right.
Ian Roberts is one of the Upright Citizens for
founding
founders,
members, right.
Right? So that was a total improv nerd dream to work with Ian.
Yeah, right.
Lovely. but we went into the room. It was the six of us with them breaking the story, and then two of us would go off in pairs, and we'd switch the pairs for every episode. We'd write the script, and we'd come back, and we'd all pitch new jokes, and we'd punch it up. And we had this wonderful woman, Jill Kargerman, who came in as a story consultant. Because we were like, you know, we have the funny, we have the characters, we have the world, we might need a little help with structure. And we were able to learn so much from her and so much from Jay and Ian about how to take those 2 minute vignettes and make them a 20 minute piece.
Well, we have to let's break for the news because news is here. Do you guys mind sticking around for one more segment? We'll do another segment here with Katie Thomas, Kate Lambert, and Caitlin Barlow, their show Teachers. It's on at 10 o'clock.
Oh, my God.
TV
we're
Land,
so
tonight, the premiere.
Watch it.
Chicago Improv gone Hollywood here in the WGN studios. When we come back, we'll talk more with them. Stay with us.
Miss Snap, I drew you a picture of us.
Thank you so much. Is that supposed to be me?
Yeah.
Where are my cheekbones? Couple tips. We have the same size wrists, so why do you draw me with a bigger body? I'm not Miley Cyrus. I don't have horse teeth. This is really bad. It's disgusting. Let's just consider this a rough draft.
Grasshopper sitting on a log. Katie did sitting on a post. Grasshopper says, you bug me, Katie, cause I dig you the most. Old grasshopper about to flip his lid. He's gonna marry that Katie did. The June bugs say it's a flat disgrace. There'd be little Katie hoppers all over the place.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Katie Thomas, Kate Lambert, Caitlin Barlow, three of the six members of the Katydids, an improv group here in Chicago that I'm sure a lot of people have seen on stage. And tonight, the whole country is going to get a chance to see Teachers on TV Land. It premieres in just a half an hour here. I'm so proud. I mean, it's great. I mean, it's amazing. Like you said earlier, it's like an improv group's dream to be able to do that. Have you learned a lot about Hollywood and the way that it works through this experience?
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, we're producers, creators, writers, and actors on the show. So
wow.
It required us to wear a lot of different hats. And so the thing is that sometimes, you know, you've got a couple hats on top. So it's so even when you're in a scene, you're thinking about the scene from all these different angles, which I think is actually really helpful for the performance. You know, you're thinking about it, yes, by your acting, but you're also going, does this joke work the best possible? You know, and we were constantly using our improv on set to be on our feet and thinking and trying to improve it in all the different ways possible.
Is it, I mean, is it the kind of set that you can do that, where you went out of your way to make sure that you guys can retake something, try something else, improv? You guys just go ahead and on the spot come up with stuff?
I don't think we got a chance to improvise as much as we would like to, but we definitely did. We would do something when we knew we had a take we liked. What did we call it? It was just like a for fun take where we would improvise and kind of just goof around. And we actually ended up using a lot of that in the final cuts.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're improvising, that's the most organic and that's the most connected that you know, a lot of times that you are. And, you know, we used improv a lot, especially with generating dialogue. We all know these characters so well that when we were in the writer's room, we would just improvise as the characters because we know what they would say.
It's amazing, too. And you mentioned Ian Roberts and the Upright Citizen Brigade. They had their own show. You think of even Stephen Colbert and Amy Sedaris and Paul Dinello had their own show, Strangers with Candy.
Yeah.
And then you start to see there's others that were able, SCTV. But the idea of comedy groups being able to take what they do on a stage, particularly here in Chicago, and be able to transfer that to television, to Hollywood, is it's few and far between. Do you recognize that? Do you recognize that you're going into like some serious company here?
Every day. I got to tell you, I mean, I am so grateful every second of every day for this experience. We really do. We have this thing where we're like, we look like six administrative assistants. We're like six homely B words with no credits, you know, from Chicago. And we just went out to L.A. and to Hollywood and had all these amazing opportunities. It totally feels surreal. We're so grateful. And I was talking on the plane ride here. We flew from New York this morning with Katie Colleton, and we were talking about how excited we get when we see people we know succeed, whether it's someone we just saw perform a little bit in Chicago, but how exciting it is when we see people. So, I mean, every time I watch SNL and I see one of those ladies that we used to play with here or watch perform, it's just... there's so much joy and pride in that.
Yeah, it's just like we're just so unbelievably grateful and excited for this opportunity. And, you know, like Katie brought it up earlier, that the whole reason that we did this is because we didn't want to wait around for an opportunity. We decided that we knew each other so well that we were going to showcase ourselves the best way we knew how, and that was writing for ourselves and writing to our strengths. And so the fact that this show is on the air and that we are all in it together is so amazing. And Jay and Ian always laugh because they say it's so funny to work with people who are so unjaded that anytime we walk into a place, I always joke around. I'm like, there's a door here. Like, I'm like,
can we walk through this? Yeah. Wait, we can sit at this desk? Oh my God, thank you.
Yeah, and we're like just so unbelievably thrilled. We're like, tiny cereal boxes?
It's great in the being able to do something creative with your vision and put it in on television. The other thing too is it's to be able to work together. The old adage and for comics in Hollywood has always been Amy Poehler says it best, get famous so you can hire your friends. I mean, that's the idea, that there's rarely ever that you have this sort of organic up everybody at the same time together as a group. You know, the Hollywood really likes that sort of like pick one and then they get something, they'll hire their friend to be a writer, that kind of thing. So it's extra special to be together as a group, the same group that was on Studio B here in Chicago.
We were really able to get, you say that, we got a lot of Chicago people on the show. So there's been a lot of people that we know from Chicago, or I'm from Detroit originally, so some people from Detroit originally. We were able to get them as characters, whether they were a larger character or just even someone in the background. I think we had at least over 20 Chicago improvisers in the show on TV Land, and that felt so good. And it was just so cool to have, like, even people that, you know, taught us at Second City, getting to work with them in that capacity was unbelievable.
Let me ask you a question. I asked this of a lot of guests on this show. What does this town mean to you? What did it do for you and the work that we're going to see tonight on TV Land?
Well, I have a Chicago tattoo, so it means a lot to me. I mean, this is our home. I mean, Chicago is absolutely a place. If you are hungry for stage time and you need to cut your teeth, this is the perfect place to do it. If you want to be on stage every single night, you can do that. And I think we all can credit Chicago for being the place where we found our comedic voices.
Yeah, and I also think the Chicago theater and improv community is a very nurturing community. You know, it's something that is welcoming, and the performers are very supportive of each other. You know, like, you can go out on stage, and any night of the week, a large majority of the audience are performers, and people go to watch and support and learn. And it has been like the most amazing experience. And like all the different schools, you know, here for improv, like, you know, everyone, we all did different ones, but, you know, I myself did like the Second City and mm-hmm. IO, and it was just going through those and learning, you know, improv and developing improv into sketch was just invaluable to us. And also the whole, you know, the biggest thing with improv is yes, and, you know, and I hate to sound like a cliche, but it's exactly what you need for this kind of work. Like, the writer's room is all about collaboration.
Yeah, right.
And so you constantly need to build upon each other's ideas. And even if maybe something doesn't sound like it's going to work right away, you're like, okay, but how can we figure out how to make this work?
I'm teaching my 8-year-old right now that concept, because
that's right.
When he says no, I'm like, why don't you say yes and? And he's just a smart kid. He goes, yes and no.
Yes and no, please.
That's like your typical it. Level A Second City, the guy in the office who's told he's the comedian.
Right. Or the third grader doesn't want to eat his vegetables,
exactly.
Right? It's interesting because we wanted to have a conversation. Pete and I were talking about just the idea that this is on TV Land, and you know, we brought it up. We're like, well, TV Land's making is really making a push towards, you know, new comedies, things like that. There's a new stuff that's coming out on the network, but we remember TV Land as sort of like the beginning of where old sitcoms are at. And we're going to do a segment on this 312-981-7200 about. I'm sick of Full House, right? I have to watch. I'm trying to introduce my son to stuff that's a little bit more wholesome. Like, I can't give him the Family Guy and stuff like that because it's just too subversive mm-hmm. in the way that it never. And so for you guys, and I guess you're now part of TV Land, what would be your recommendations of old sitcoms that would have a heart an 8-year-old would get into from the 80s, from the 90s? What were the stuff that you were watching as kids?
I watched a lot of I Love Lucy.
Oh, okay.
I loved that show. I just thought it was such a great show. Lucille Ball was amazing. I was also a huge Gilda Radner fan with SNL. Okay. My parents introduced me to her at a very young age. So that, you know, like those old SNL are just so unbelievable to watch.
All right. So he's big in SNL. He's a big Will Ferrell kid.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I would say I think he should be in fifth grade before he watches it. But I would honestly, Golden Girls.
Oh,
it's
yes.
so good, and it stands up. That show has stood the test of time.
Golden
it is
Girls
so
is
good.
Amazing. It really is.
And, just in a study of comedy, like the setup, crash, like
right.
every single joke is, you know, Rose, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, B. Arthur, brr. And it just is this classic comedic pattern.
All right, one for Golden Girls.
Yeah, you know, well, it's not a sitcom. I'm a weirdo.
Should you say Breaking Bad for your son?
Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, Masters of Sex. Now, my dad has a weird sense of humor, and he had me watching Monty Python at a very early age. I think I was watching Holy Grail by fifth grade. Fifth grade was the first time I saw it, and I really latched on to it. And Caitlin and I connected over this recently that she also started watching it about the same time, and we were watching Flying Circus. And it's funny because so many of those references went completely over my head. I didn't know about the British Parliament. I didn't know about all these historical references or
philosophers.
Right, right.
But it's so silly.
Right.
So the really broad stuff,
well, that's
like
a good idea,
the silly walks and the it's like the idiot of the year or something like that, where it's kind of like an obstacle course for these just total morons. you know, I think there's some just really fun, just pure silliness in Monty Python.
It's interesting because we were talking about, I was like, maybe Family Ties, because that's kind of like
Family Ties is fantastic.
It's fantastic. And I went and I was annoyed because I set up on my DVR Full House, and now I have like 180 Full Houses, and they're terrible. I can't stand that show. And I've watched it with him, and he likes it. And I'm like trying to wean him off it. So I'm like, oh, what about Family Ties? So I started watching Family Ties. Maybe I picked the wrong episode, but it is so much more cerebral, thoughtful, kind of, we're a wholesome family. And we're kind of liberal, and Alex is conservative. And he was just like, I don't even know where I'm supposed to laugh. Like, besides Mallory's boyfriend, who's the guy who comes out, I was like, hey. And like, he did not relate at all to Alex B. Keaton in that thing. And I was just like, oh, man, I really have to shift gears. So I'm hoping that you can these suggestions might be the suggestions from TV Land stars.
Yeah, you should get your hands on Dinosaurs. Do you remember
classic
that?
90 cents.
Not the Mama.
Oh, yeah. Right.
I love that one, too.
Yeah. I mean, I was weird, too. I loved the really, like, cheesy. I was all about the TGIF. You know, I loved Mr. Belvedere. I loved Perfect Strangers.
Perfect Strangers might
be good.
You know,
Perfect Strangers was really fun as a kid. Yeah, I loved that show.
And in Chicago?
Yeah.
I was going to say that. Yeah.
And I was thrilled that the family on Step by Step was a Lambert family. I was like, it's possible.
Is that the one with possible. Suzanne Summers?
Heck yes. Yeah. And Patrick Duffy?
No.
Yeah. It was like a modern Brady Bunch.
That it was.
Yeah.
That it was. All right. So we're going to let you guys go. 10 o'clock, Teachers premieres on TV Land. And this is amazing for the Katie Dids, a Chicago improv group that's now in Los Angeles. They're the producers, the stars, the writers, authored all the episodes. Katie Thomas, Kate Lambert, and Caitlin Barlow are in studio with me. The other three, their names?
Kate Friedman.
Katie O'Brien.
Katie Colleton.
There you go. There they are. Katie Dids are on TV Land. Is it going to be Wednesday nights at 10?
This first week, it'll be 10 o'clock because we follow Younger, and that's an hour-long episode for the premiere, but then we'll be on at 9:30.
So 9:30 for the rest of the remainder, but tonight, 10 o'clock.
You got it. Yes.
Congratulations again, and thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
It's a download here on WGN Radio, getting some texts in. 815 says, married with children. Which I can't tell if they're joking or not. I feel like that would be so inappropriate for an 8-year-old, right? But they say Al Bundy's insults know no age. Three Stooges made it as well. 312-981-7200 if you have a good suggestion. I can't watch another episode of Family or enough Full House. They're adding kids now.
Oh, there's more kids?
There's a ton of kids. Yeah, they run out. You know, they run out of sequence when they're on. I think they're on Nickelodeon or whatever. So it'll be like everywhere when they truncate that theme song, you know it's trouble. When it just goes because that's later, and there's two twin kids under the Olsons. So there's the Olsen girl, and then they have two twin boys that Uncle Jesse has. And it's just gimmick city. So tomorrow night, we're on from 10 to 11. We're on after the Blackhawks. The Blackhawks play the Canadiens tomorrow night. We'll be on at 10 o'clock tomorrow. So actually for that game, the pregame with Judd is at 6 o'clock. The puck drops with John and Troy at 6:30. It's a perfect time to give you the latest installment of Know Your Enemy. Here's Judd Surratt's Know Your Enemy, the Montreal Canadiens.
Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
He is my enemy.
This is Know Your Enemy on 720 WGN.
Enemy.
Here's Judd Surratt.
This year, Montreal was billed as a more complete team, that they were greater than Carey Price, last year's NHL MVP and goalie of the year. The Canadiens sprinted out to the top of the NHL standings, posting a 17-4-2 record to begin the year. Then Price got hurt in late November, and the Habs lost 14 of the next 20 and tumbled back to the pack that's fighting for a playoff spot in the East. While Price is out, Princeton grad Mike Condon has taken over the Nets.
Malkin, down low, Crosby, Harkness, Crosby, stopped by Condon, who robs him with a glove. Boy, Mike Condon has come to play tonight. Maybe his best save right there.
The rookie from Massachusetts has performed admirably with a respectable 235 goals against average. The problem? The Canadiens went into a deep freeze offensively. Since Price's injury, Montreal has been held to two or fewer goals in 16 of 20 games. The Habs offense got a jolt, however, when feisty scorer Brendan Gallagher returned from a busted finger for the Winter Classic.
It just felt good to be a part of the team again and to get on the ice and battle with the guys. And that was really the part you missed when you're injured, you're away from them so much. You feel like you're kind of away from the team that you can't really contribute in any way. So just to be a part of it and go through that again was pretty special.
Even with Gallagher back, it's a thin group up front. 6'2 sniper Max Pacioretty is the team's only pure scorer, finishing fifth or better in goals each of the last 2 years. Thomas Plekanec is an effective two-way centerman, And Montreal is hoping 21-year-old Alex Galchenyuk, who played for the Chicago Young Americans, can build off of last year's 20-goal season. The Canadiens also miss gritty Dale Weiss, off to a surprising start offensively this year with a career-high 11 goals, which ranks second on the team. But Weiss is on injured reserve after suffering an upper body injury during the Winter Classic, taking away a much-needed net presence for an undersized mix of forwards. The Canadiens expected more from flamboyant defenseman P.K. Subban.
We're trying to win hockey games every night, and, you know, I have to be a big part of that. I have to be a leader in that, and sometimes, you know, maybe sending a message to your teammates and showing that you care about it is important as well. So, you know, I'm fine to take the criticism. I'll get better from it.
Subban, who has one of the league's hardest shots, has been limited to only 2 goals this season. 37-year-old Andrei Markov still logs the big matchup minutes. Alexi Emelin is a ferocious open-ice hitter on the blue line, and the Canadiens are high on the all-around game of 23-year-old first-round pick Nathan Beaulieu. GM Mark Bergevin, who spent time in hockey operations and played for the Blackhawks, is one of the slickest GMs in the league. His all-star goalie is due back sometime after the NHL all-star break in February, and look for Bergevin to parlay some limited cap space and a few tradable assets to make Montreal contender for the Eastern Conference title, with an outside shot at winning the team's 24th Stanley Cup and its first since 1993. For Know Your Enemy, I'm Judd Surratt.
Keep your enemies close.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. All right. Very excited. Saba is coming up after the news. This Powerball stuff will be over by then. I see Twitter blowing up because they just put the numbers out. Coming up right after the news, we'll talk with Saba, West Side rapper, who is dropping a brand new track today. It's out. But let's get a Chicago radio premiere here on WGN 720. I love it. That's amazing. I think Wally Phillips would be proud. He'd be proud of our moving out of just talk to now rivaling the commercial music radio stations in town. It's just how it worked out. I'm very excited. Saba coming up. Also, Sam Penjanovic going to come on a little bit later to talk about the big proposed boycott. Number one, Morgan Park does not want to play against Simeon unless it's at their shop, at the gym. But the gym, way too small. CPS won't let the game be played there. So what's going to happen? Will they play the game? Will they forfeit? Sam Penjanovic has got the inside scoop. We'll talk to him after 10:30. Right now it's time for the news. It's 10:02. Here's Rob Martier.
It's cloudy and 24 at O'Hare. Let's begin with Powerball. Officials saying there's an 85% chance that the winning ticket for tonight's jackpot has been sold. UCLA film instructor Dallas King, standing in line outside a liquor store in Hawthorne, California today, was a surprise ticket buyer.
I actually came here to buy gum. And then I realized it's the lottery today. So gum and, I'm going to get something to drink. And then, hey, we'll get a lottery ticket while we're here.
Come on. That's the news clip where you're like, I was standing in line. And,
we're running low.
No, I blame you. I blame every right now they have the number one news guys on every single station, the 10 o'clock news going, let's go to Patrick Johnson, who's standing by the 7-Eleven. We talked to somebody. Here's what he had to say. Just bought a ticket. Can't believe, this is for Greg. Gonna get some milk too.
So what are you gonna do with it?
I'm gonna do a ton. I'm just gonna pay off my bills. Come on, man. All right.
I like Cochran this morning. Who are you gonna cut out of your life?
I got burned out, so I dropped out. See, I turned out okay on the Holy Bible today, like a teacher's in the 12th grade. On my entrance essay, I just want to live, find a college.
Welcome back to the download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, I guess tonight is a rapper from the West Side. You may have seen him electrifying the Late Show with Stephen Colbert stage next to Chance the Rapper.
Hey, let's talk it. Woo, this is what the band. City's so damn great, I feel like Alexander. Wear your halo like a hat, that's like the latest fashion. I got angels all around me, they keep me surrounded.
or on stage at the North Coast Music Festival. Wherever you've seen him, you remember him. His name is Saba, and he's a name to watch in Chicago hip-hop. His 2014 release, Comfort Zone, was given critical acclaim, and the earlier reference track, Angels, that was performed on Colbert, can be heard all over the radio here in Chicago, featuring Chance. And new music out today. Saba is 21 years old, grew up in Austin, and made his way up through the poetry scene here in Chicago, and he's my guest tonight on The Download. Saba, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to see you. Your music's great. Congratulations on the new music. It's interesting because the first thing I said is my guest tonight is a rapper from the West Side, because a lot of the rap scene here in Chicago focuses almost primarily on the South Side, at least the names that may, you know, become more mainstream. What's it like to be a rapper from the West Side?
I think it's awesome. It's interesting because Chicago is like really celebrated in hip hop right now, but it's pretty much like a specific part of Chicago still. And I think one of my goals is to make a more like unified Chicago, or think, like just image of Chicago.
Yeah, why do you think that is? Why do you think it's only? I mean, it's obvious there's different sides of Chicago. Yeah. Why is it that it's a particular one pocket?
I wish I knew the answer. It would make my job like so much easier. but I think it is getting better. I think there are like acts like there's a few guys from Save Money that are from the West Side. It's a few West Siders that are coming up, and I think now, like this year and like moving forward, I think the West Side will be a more celebrated place in Chicago. I think it's still, because it's not necessarily just rap music. It's like the entire West Side, like just as a side. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, let's talk about your career, because you're 21 years old. You've already put music out that's critically acclaimed. I mean, not too many 21-year-olds I know that are up rapping on the stage at the Late Show on Stephen Colbert. but let's talk about your upbringing, because you grew up in Austin and you had a musical family.
Yeah. I was raised with my grandparents, but my dad does music and his dad does music and his brother does music. So it's like I've always been inspired by just watching my dad, and I've always been like exposed to music being a primary source of like your living. Like the people around me were trying to make a living off of music, so it was like I never really had that fear of, you know,
new to you. You knew you were a kid in a studio.
Yeah, basically. And I think I was always just intrigued by it. Like being like 4 or 5 and being in a studio, it's like I don't know how to use any of this equipment, but I know that the lights look cool. And so it's like I always wanted to get involved in it somehow. I never really knew what exactly I would end up doing, but I know I think I was probably 7. My great-grandmother had a piano at her house, and we visited her, and I played Mary Had a Little Lamb, and she just offered to let me have the piano. So that was like my real start in music. And then after that I started producing probably when I was like 9, and we just started like dubbing like cassettes at home, and since then it's pretty much been both feet like in.
Your music is really, really sophisticated in the sense that it doesn't sound, you know, it doesn't sound unproduced. It's very polished. I mean, the 2014 record Comfort Zone, I mean, it is it's radio ready. And a lot of that has to do with the production, obviously. Yeah. But the lyrics are really, they're sophisticated in the way that you're telling stories. Where does that come from for you? Because I did mention that you came up in the poetry scene here, but it seems like the lyrics are front forward for you, and they're trying to tell a story.
I think for me, the poetry influence is one of like the biggest reasons for that. Like I said, I was always in music, but it wasn't until I was maybe like 16 and 17 when I kind of started getting involved in the open mics and stuff like that, where I really felt this like obligation to like tell what my story is, and like being this like West Sider who, you know what I'm saying, like kind of was involved in all of these different things. But I think that just witnessing like the poetry scene for like the first time, it's like it's really personal, and all of these people are going up there sharing stories, and it's just really crazy to witness, especially so young, because sometimes the people that you're watching are even younger than you. So it was dope to just see people share their stories, and it inspired me to want to share mine.
And you hear so many people coming up,
really what it was,
through, you know, young Chicago authors and other places, and not just, you know, as a place to hone your craft as a poet or a lyricist, but also to make relationships. because a lot of the rappers that are blowing up out of Chicago right now are from that area. I mean, Chance the Rapper specifically has come and continues to give back to the sort of poetry scene here in Chicago.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's crazy, like, to see where it's all going now. It's like being at UMedia, which was downtown Harold Washington Library. We used to all go to UMedia together or whatever. And to just see where everybody's career is kind of going toward now is kind of crazy to witness. But yeah, it all kind of started like meeting like-minded individuals, I guess, at a young age. And then from there, the constant belief and just working with people who you're fans of, like working with your friends and seeing where that has kind of platformed now is like kind of crazy to just witness.
New music out today from Saba, a rapper from the west side of Chicago. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the new music and also about what's next for you, because it's not just about what you've done in the new music, but it's about growing and maturing. You're 21 years old. Really, go to YouTube and check out the Stephen Colbert performance of Angels. It's not just a performance. I mean, you guys take the whole stage. That's what I love about it. It's so fresh, especially for something on Late Night Talk Show. We'll talk with Saba some more here after the break. Stay with us.
And now you vagabond. Funny they tagged along. Back when you had the dog, you knocked on heaven's door and asked them to spare change. They only spare in love. You probably run away. Everything's temporary.
Money's so temporary. And poor is so temporary. And new friends so temporary. And so is the cemetery. Money's so temporary. And poor is so temporary. And new friends so temporary. And so is the cemetery.
Everything is temporary. Who are you to judge me now? Even when I'm low and weary, I'll get up again somehow.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Saba. Saba, new music today. Exciting? Is it feel?
So exciting. I dropped one song last year. So it's been pretty much me just on my computer making a bunch of music. So this is the first release. It's GPS is the name of the song.
All right.
And it drops today.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of it.
Who can make you forget that we're all as famished? They owe me like the new kid. This my college campus. Ooh, all these women want me like my name was Channing. Tatum, I don't even take them. Y'all can all still have them. Like I got my own. Pre-kill man still up on board. And get old fan talking about they poor. And be broke talking like they own. I don't really care what I say though. They change their self for compensation. Last year I just had to lay low. Now pass the torch like hot potato. Cause I'm on it, take the green line out west to Austin. Got the best projects since the chronic. Like a nerd freshman, how I'm locked in, I been off that. Devin, then I don't rematch. Grimo, I don't relax. Hey, go ahead and pay this back. Sad.
Talk about how this music, GPS, and the music you're producing now differs from what you were doing just a year ago or 2 years ago in 2014.
I think with the release of Comfort Zone, I guess it dropped in 2014, but a lot of those songs were recorded way before then, like 2012. Some were like kind of conceptualized even before that. So it was like a very young.
You're 18 years old at that. Like.
Yeah.
Jeez, yeah.
A lot of the songs, I'm like 18, maybe 19 on some of them. So I think now it's like you get to really hear the, I guess, like a more mature Saba.
What is a more mature Saba?
I think one thing that I've been really trying to focus on is just the recording artistry. I think with Comfort Zone and a lot of my like past projects and stuff, I always knew that I had like a talent. I think the music is good. I think the raps are like, you know, I like to think it's exceptional like stuff. But I think for me, it's like trying to really capture the right takes and the right energy on the songs. Like sometimes I'll record a song and then I'll perform it and it'll be just like a complete two different experiences. So I think Comfort Zone was like a learning process. And I think now it's like a more like refined, you know, we did a lot of fine tuning.
Well, let me ask you, because it's 2016, for you to move forward and to think of your career at 21 years old as, you know, it's still brand new. I mean, even though we're talking about stuff that you recorded and produced in 2012, 2013, when you're 18 years old, where do you see yourself going? What are the goals for Saba? I mean, is it to, I mean, you're part of this unbelievable independent movement here in Chicago, where it's one of the things that I think people are going to look back on the generation of rappers that are happening, hip-hop right now, and see that it's changed the way music is produced in general. What do you see as a long-term goal for you in your career?
Honestly, I want that exact sentence that you just said to be a part of like what it is that I do and help inspire other people to do. Not necessarily just telling everybody, hey, stay independent or stuff like that, but just allowing people to kind of believe in themselves and push themselves forward without necessarily just spending their careers waiting for that extra hand. Because it's like now it's like, you know, you have the studio, you have the internet. It's like you have the tools to build a solid fan base and a solid source of income, I feel like, early on. So now it's like it's a completely different ball game. I feel like it's a very diverse Chicago rap scene right now. And I'm honored to be talked about, I think, as much as I am. And I think from here on out, it's like just a matter of kind of just taking it a step further.
Well,
each
day. Let me ask you about your lyrics, because, you know, there was a lot of social justice and a feel to the stuff that you had in Comfort Zone. There was, you know, you were rapping about your life. You were talking about some of the issues that were happening on the west side of Chicago. Do you see yourself being a writer in that regard as you move forward? Do you see yourself continuing that legacy or to tell people about where you're from and some of the issues that are happening in those communities?
I think for me, it's just observation. It's a matter of observation, and it's like you can see when something is wrong, and it's like this is not how this is supposed to be. So it's, I don't know. I'm hoping it just, I guess, like inspire some other, like how we were talking about, like there aren't many like West Side, not just musicians, but just West Side
spokespeople.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So I don't know who will be the person who kind of brings like that side of the city to light. But if I could have something to do with it, or maybe inspire the person who does, like that would be, you know what I'm saying, like a goal of mine.
Well, I'm always interested because you see this a lot in mainstream rap, where you'll have somebody who comes up through the ranks, who's hungry, who's observational about where they came from, and maybe they're telling a story or they're telling their story.
Yeah.
And then they get further along, and I think, you know, I think you're seeing a little bit with Kanye West is a great example, and you know, a genius in my mind, but now his raps are about Nike and Adidas, you know, like they're not about, you know, working at the Ford City Mall. And and the question, you know, for you as a young rapper who's, you know, you're starting to see some success, here comes some new music, you've already shared the stage at the Late Show and Colbert. Do you think about that kind of stuff? If your work is observational, that, you know, like in 15 years, you can be like, I didn't say sparkling water, I said regular water.
I don't know. I think...
How do you keep real, I guess, is the question, as you get more and more people around you and your experiences change?
With making art in general, it's a challenging thing to kind of grow in art, because once you're known for something, that's what you're expected to do. When I feel like really art is a reflection of, you know, yourself. So as your surroundings change,
right,
it's only natural that your art changes. But I think the your core beliefs should still, you know, come through on the song. Like if you were seeking to inspire these people in the beginning, it's 15 years later. Maybe they're inspired by now. Maybe you need something else to rap about, inspire a new group of people or something like that. So I don't really know. It's kind of hard to say, you know, especially being 21 and kind of winging it so far.
Well, here's a question for you. I mean, you are moving into a different arena where, you know, you are inspiring younger hip-hop artists because of your success. You know, like you said, I mean, having the being featured on a Chance song and working with more audiences and people around you to see you, there's a 14-year-old kid on the West Side who's like, hey, I want to do what Saba did. Do you see that? I mean, you're 21 years old. It's hard to say, I mean, because you're still on your way up. But do you recognize that, you know, because of your situation of only not a lot of rappers from the West Side that you could be inspiring to people who might be coming up?
I recognize it. I get it every now and then. But I think what's important is because, like, it's still so early. It's still very early. And that's what I try to tell them. Like, it's like I haven't done anything yet compared to where our goals really are and what we really want to do. It's like we haven't even really got our foot in the door compared to how we want our foot in the door. So it's like, do better than me, do way better than me, do, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, surpass this by a lot. And I think that's the real kind of.
How do you get there? I mean, I'm fascinated by this because, I mean, is it going to be just touring? I mean, is the idea now that you've produced this music and this music continues to get a critical acclaim, attention? I mean, is the way that Saba moves to the next level where, you know, iTunes is putting you on the front page saying you got to get this new track and you're on the freshman list and things like that? I mean, is that the kind of thing that happens by you just going town to town and hustling?
I don't really know. Rap, or I guess music in general, is so weird because there's no real success indicator. Like, it's like with all of these other, like, fields, it's like, you do this, you get a promotion. You do this, you're the manager now. You know, you move up in the ranks a certain way. But in, like, music, it's like, you can be in the top 10 on iTunes and nobody's ever heard of you. Like, that is a possibility now. It's crazy, like, because a lot of us are we know how we envision the future, and we have no idea how to make it happen, but we just know that it will happen. So it's like we're taking, like, this blind, like, just walk, like, with nothing but faith in, like, our craft and that people will like this. And it's such a, like, crazy idea sometimes. It's like we're recording these records, which Comfort Zone was recorded in my basement, and then we're putting it out and hoping for the best.
Let me end here. Let me ask you one last question. I mean, we've talked a lot about the West Side, but for you, what does it mean to you to be Chicago's Saba?
Oh, man, Chicago Saba. I think that's that's one of, like, the underlying just messages of every song I've probably ever recorded. Especially going out of town now and being, you know, blessed with the opportunity to tour a little bit more. They embrace me as Chicago Saba. So it's only right that when I come home, it's the same embrace as Chicago Saba. I think it's been probably hands down the most important piece in the music that I've recorded so far. Just that Chicago story and telling it like it is has gotten me this far. So I don't see it, you know, changing anytime soon.
Saba's new music out today, the track GPS. You can check out his other work, Comfort Zone. And you got any shows coming up?
Not in Chicago.
See, you got to hustle. you give us a list of all the strange shows you're going to have coming up here in North Carolina, Alabama, all the way down, right? Saba, thanks for being here, and it was a pleasure. And continued success, and I hope you come back.
All right, thanks for having me, man. Same to you.
Big brouhaha tonight. Obviously, everyone talking Powerball, but the story I saw today that I thought was really interesting was that family members of some of the kids that are playing at Morgan Park. Morgan Park is the number one basketball team. It's having an unbelievable season. But I didn't recognize, and I didn't know this, that they've been asking for a couple years since they became a powerhouse program for a new gym. The gym is really, really small. 200 people in the CPS school. They're playing Simeon this weekend, and a big game, and everybody's excited about it. And there are calls for the team to boycott because the game was supposed to be played at Morgan Park. And the CPS, Chicago Public Schools, has moved the game as they have the last couple of years when these two teams get together. On the line with me right now, Sam Panjanovic. He covers sports for WGN Radio. Sam, good to talk to you.
Controversy on the south side. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. This is interesting because Morgan Park, this is the battle of Vincennes is the way it's been called. So talk a little bit about this rivalry and the controversy.
Well, you've got 10 state championships between the two schools. Simeon has won 7. Morgan Park has won 3. They're separated by 30 blocks on the south side. It's like a 15-minute drive. Morgan Park's 111th in Vincennes and Beverly, and Simeon's at 81st in Vincennes. So it doesn't take long to get there. And Morgan Park won the first meeting this year at Simeon. But a lot of the parents are upset because Morgan Park continues to lose these high-profile games against Simeon because of the capacity of the gym, like you mentioned. They only fit like 250 people. And CPS and Morgan Park, the principal, Carolyn Epps, it's her call where to play the games. And she's decided in years past to move them to get bigger crowds and, I'm assuming, a bigger piece of the pot. But the family members of these players at Morgan Park have had enough. And Tiffany Burrell, who is the mother of junior player Romello Burrell, has led a charge. They've sent a statement that if the game is not at Morgan Park, they're not playing.
Wow. So the team would forfeit the game. I mean, in this scenario, Morgan Park, which has been at number one all season long, this would be a big blow for them to essentially forfeit a loss.
Well, it doesn't really change anything. They're going to the postseason either way. They'll be one of the top teams in the tournament. It doesn't matter what seed they have. And they can afford a loss here in January. They're already 12-1 this season, so they have a loss. I think this is more politics than basketball because they want a new gym. I mean, before they played Simeon last year, the team warmed up with shirts that said, "We need a new gym," literally on the cover of their shirt. And it's interesting, if you follow the money trail in CPS, which sometimes can be a little difficult, Whitney Young got $17 million from a tax increment financing fund in 2014. And they were able to build 11 classrooms. They built a brand new gym for basketball, a fitness room, all this stuff. And Morgan Park's just sitting down there in Beverly like, hey, you know, the gym isn't big enough. Well, let's get a new gym. But those concerns haven't been answered.
So the they don't answer those questions. They just kind of pass
them. Right, yeah. And Nick Irvin didn't answer any questions. And I tried to reach out to everybody I could. I got turned down at every door. I got pies thrown in my face. But there hasn't been a push to give Morgan Park the money to build this new gym, yet they're being penalized because their current gym isn't big enough. So figure that out.
So, you know, this is interesting because it does have a history, because going back a few years, they've been doing this for a couple of years. In 2012, 2013, they played the game at Chicago State, and that was well documented. There was a shooting, and a Morgan Park student was killed outside that game. So they stopped playing them at Chicago State, and now they play them at a different high school. Is that how it goes?
Well, the plan this year is to play at Gwendolyn Brooks, which is actually a stone's throw from Morgan Park. It's on 111th Street, just across the highway. Then the plan was to move it to Little Village, which is on 31st and Costner.
Wow, that's way far, yeah.
Not exactly very close for Morgan Park and their fans, so I would see where that would be a problem. But it's about the money. Little Village holds 1,900 people. Brooks holds almost 1,000. Morgan Park holds 250. So, you know, for the Morgan Park parents to say that they want their kids to play in front of their student section, I understand that. That's fine and dandy. But you're going to get more exposure, more fans. Your kids will be seen by more eyes if it's played at a bigger gym. I can see this kind of, maybe they do forfeit, and that sort of, you know, maybe swings the meter to help CPS realize that, hey, we better satisfy Morgan Park because this program isn't going anywhere but up. But they seem to be standing along a fine line. They say that if they don't have an answer by the end of the workday tomorrow, Thursday, they will tell all of their kids to sit out and forfeit the game and take a loss.
Well, you know, I mean, they're trying to get the media's attention and obviously the city's attention, and we're talking about it and the newspapers are talking about it. I've seen it tonight on Twitter, it retweeted. People are writing, whether it be DNA or the Sun-Times, people are writing about this issue, an issue that they haven't, that the parents feel like they haven't gotten the attention of the city, CPS, and the leaders. They just keep ignoring them. So I can understand if it's year after year after year, something has to give. But the idea of forfeiting a game, especially a high-profile game against Simeon, seems to be a little bit of a head-scratcher.
Yeah, I mean, it's just bad for the look of high school basketball in Illinois. You know, you've got, like I said, three state titles for Morgan Park. They won it in 2013 and 2014. We know the history with Simeon. They won four in a row with Jabari Parker. Derrick Rose won two at Simeon. Ben Wilson won one in the early 80s at Simeon. So there's a lot of history, lots of good players from both sides, and it really robs Chicago high school basketball fans, and really any fan of basketball in the Windy City, of just high-quality basketball. It was 70-65 at Simeon, which means Morgan Park doesn't even need to play at home to win. You know, home field advantage didn't matter. And I was at that game. There were 1,400 people standing room only, and they were turning away hundreds of people at the door. So the demand is great. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that want to go here. So I understand what CPS and what the principal want to do. They want to get as many people as possible to satisfy the demands.
Well, I mean, there's safety issues included. I mean, you can't have a gym of 250 people with 1,400 people showing up.
No, and you brought up the shooting, the fatal shooting. Tyrone Lawson got shot in 2013 outside, and they had to separate the teams after the postgame handshake. It was a really tightly contested game, and the fight kind of spilled out into the parking lot, and there was a fatal shooting. So security has always been on high alert, and even when you have the security there in 2013, something unfortunate and tragic still happened. So I don't think that there's an outcome that pleases everybody for this game on Saturday. But going forward, you have to imagine that Morgan Park, which was founded 100 years ago, it was founded in 1916. You would think maybe they have a little more power now to raise the funds, help Chicago Public Schools realize that they should be compensated, give them a new gym.
And you know, this is not an issue that's going to go away. If anything, when the reporters that are assigned to politics or assigned to covering education get a hold of these stories, they're going to be a little bit more expansive than how they're being written for college basketball. But you know what's great about this is, or high school basketball, what's great is this is tells everybody, and I guess it's a somewhat of a secret, but not much of a secret if 1,400 people are showing up. High school basketball in Chicago is a hot ticket, and Morgan Park and Simeon are two of the best teams that are playing right now. It's amazing to think that many people show up to a high school basketball game.
Well, basketball has always been popular here in this city, and Morgan Park is top ranked. They're number one in all the polls, probably the best team in the state. They've won two titles in the last 3 years. Simeon ranked number three, so and we think about all the kids that have played in college from these two programs. I mean, you got Derrick Rose and Jabari Parker. I'm sure Charlie Moore, who's going to Memphis, is going to play in the NBA. You've got Marcus Levette, who played there last year. I mean, you've got so much talent from the south side of Chicago that really decides between these two schools a lot of times. It's the highest quality game. These teams always make deep runs into the postseason. So there are plenty of eyes. I'm sure you've seen all the social media fallout. And I just wonder how long it takes to get this solved. But I will say one thing. I played high school basketball, and anytime we got a chance to go play at a kick-ass gym, I was all for it. Oh my God, we get to go play at the UIC Pavilion? Yes, you know, it beats our crappy gym. But it shows you how much things have changed over the landscape of power, and the parents are the ones leading the boycott. Can you imagine if a parent went up in like the 60s and 70s and said, yeah, we're going to take our kid out of the game? That wouldn't happen.
Yeah. You know, it says a lot, too, just about inequality and attempting to get, you know, what's best for your kid when you're just seeing a couple miles up the road, state-of-the-art in other places. So I can understand with Morgan Park being a school that continues to be at the top of the heap, as the stats that evidence from Sam. Sam Panjanovic, WGN Radio Sports, thanks for the update.
I missed the Powerball number by one. I'm so upset.
Yeah, I could have told you that was going to happen. Coming up next, Patty Vasquez will be here. Pretty late with Patty Vasquez. More with Sketchfest, which is great. There'll be more groups in here. The show's over. Katie Didd's The Teachers is over, Pete. Anybody watch it, call us and let us know. 312-981-7200. Text and say, I loved it. I hated it. Oh, my God.
I have to say that I watched the pilot episode, and I really enjoyed the pilot. So I hope I hope this thing is a hit.
I love the web series. I thought it was great. It's funny concept. But some of the jokes we played were really funny. It's good. And Saba's new track's out, so that's good. We'll see how it goes on the...
Congratulations on the debut, the Chicago debut.
That's right. It was nice to be, Chicago premiere here on 720. That's what it's going to be, you know. We should have had him you're listening to the download on WGN, and we could just play that and put some beats behind it. Pew, 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 pew. All night.
I prefer that.
All night. Lock it, lock it. Yeah. Saba. So Powerball's over.
Yeah.
That's good. Good. I'm glad that went away. Someone won. Good.
Somebody from Chino Hills, California.
I'm not a big lotto guy. I've never been a big lotto guy. I hate the hype on it. Chino Hills.
The only thing that I know about Chino, of course, is from the...
What I call it, Chico Hills?
No, Chino.
Chino Hills. Yeah.
Chino it must be a different place, because if you are a fan of the Fox program, The OC, you know, with Peter Gallagher, mm-hmm. Ryan, kind of the tough guy, he's from Chino. He gets taken into the OC because the Chino's a bad neighborhood. He gets taken into the OC and comes with the family.
Right.
But then, like, I'm reading about Chino Hills, and I see pictures, and it looks amazing, and it's like it's high income, apparently. So
if I won the Powerball ticket and I lived in Chino Hills, I'd give like $800 million of it to water.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah, I just give it to the water department and be like, yo, man, make some of this saltwater water so we don't die.
That.
Right?
Boy, very altruistic.
But then they make a statue of me at the water plant, so that's kind of cool. You know, I mean, what are you really looking for? I mean, not all of it. I mean, still keep like 3-4 million.
Yeah, we don't, you know.
We play, no.
I mean, yeah, when it gets to over a billion, that's usually when we buy the ticket.
Well, you know, that's what we were saying before. We played the worst on Monday or last week, and someone said the Today Show anchors, you know, saying, I got my ticket. Rich people playing lottery is the worst. And there's a lot of consternation online about Kim Kardashian. She put something out like, hey, everyone get their Powerball tickets? Shut up. Nobody asked you. You don't get to. You should have like a bank statement that comes in and be like, "Yo, man, anything over like $200,000, you're out. You can't. No, the same for you." So that's kind of annoying. That's the annoying part of it. Like, I feel like all I've seen this whole time is like, "Yay, we're gonna go have Powerball. I'm gonna buy my office Powerball," and I'm like, "I don't think you're. It's not for you." I hate to be so elitist about it. It's not for you. It's like when. You saw like a lot of bros listening to the Beastie Boys. You're like, this is not for you. They're like, this is great. This is awesome, bro. No, it's not. It's not for you. They're not making it for you. Stop. Right. That's kind of how I feel about Powerball.
So. Or going back to the death of David Bowie, they saw Crocs, you know, tweeting about the death of David Bowie, you know, when brands like Hop On or something like that.
Crocs, we wanted to say David Bowie was instrumental in our plastic footwear. It's not for you. That should be a new segment. It's not for you. Right?
Yeah. Ugh.
All right. Well, coming up tomorrow, we are on from 10 to 11. Same with Friday. I think it's a little earlier, maybe like 9:30 to 11. So we will be on later in the night around this time. Coming up next, Patty Vasquez.